On the division of revenue, we'll do it a bit later. So after the minutes, we'll go on to the presentation. We may have a slight challenge after lunch because there may be a voting in the House, so members may be needed there. So we have thought that we'll have the whole afternoon, but we may not. So if we went hard, we should be done before 3, so that we are allowed to be in the House for matters that requires voting. So that's how we're going to manage. So we'll do all the hearings and then later we'll adopt the report, because on Thursday we need to present the report on the division of revenue for adoption by House. So it means the committee must adopt first. So I've asked the chief just to finalize that draft so that we can look at it and adopt it. It won't be a long document. We will look at it later. Probably we'll end with it. Try and do it before 3 so that we are ready for tomorrow. So welcome. We'll obviously introduce our visitors as we start with presentation. So for now, let me therefore, if members agree with what I'm saying, I take it you adopt this agenda, but we understand that probably we'll finish by 2 and not 1:30 because of we are needed in the House. So we'll see how it goes. I'm hoping that by that time we should have had everybody, those who are going to present to us. Do I see a mover for adoption? Honorable Jalung, do you move?
Yes, sir.
You move for adoption. Honorable Sheikh?
Aye.
The second? Agreed? Thank you very much. The the minutes. First one was the 21st of October. Okay, I'm told that the minutes of the 21st in fact were already adopted, but there was an omission of the members of the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education, so they have now been included, so we can re-adopt those without any hesitation because it was just that small amendment. Do I see a mover on the minute of the 21st? Honorable Swabasa moves. Any second up? Any second up 21st? When I could think, so done with the 21st, the second one. The 21st, are those minutes okay? 23rd of October, that's a briefing by the Minister of Finance. Is that agreed to? Honorable Sheikh, you move.
Yes, sir.
Second, Honorable McCloly. That the next one was the 28th, 24th. The 24th, it was the joint briefing by National Treasury. Do I see an agreement on those minutes? I'm looking, looking for a mover. Honorable Pramatambu, Honorable McLaughlin, second. Oh, I saw you, Honorable Fink, second, yes. And then the next one was 28, it was written by HSRC. Do I see an agreement? Honorable Shoppes Tole moved, Senate seconder. Honorable McLaughlin, you were there. Okay. 29, it was joint with the select committee and plus the FFC and the budget office. Do I see an agreement? I'm looking. Honorable Kate moves. The seconder. Honorable Papa, the second. That concludes all set of minutes that we are standing. You can see we had a very busy week with all the briefing. Honorable Papa. So all that's the minutes. What I'm going to do now, I know that we're going to start with the presentation by Equal Education. And yeah, I'm told they are not yet here, but Nomsa is here. Is Nomsa ready?
Yeah.
So what we will do, we will then take the presentation by Nomsa. So we just swap around so that we don't lose the time, because we really don't have the time today. If you look at the time allocation there, they amount to about 45 minutes. If the presenters can do with less than that, it will help us a lot. Yes, Honorable.
Honorable Chairperson, sorry to sound like a stuck record here, but I think it's important in the light of the fact that tomorrow there is going to be a debate. And we have members of this committee, which is a standing committee on appropriations, that have standing apologies. Now, and the issue has been raised before, but I would just like to repeat that we need to, I request that we deal with the matter as a matter of urgency, please, Honorable Chairperson.
Yeah, not now, later.
But just a clarification, you see tomorrow, those members that have standing apologies might be speaking. So I'll leave it to yourself, but I just, that's one of the reasons why I'm raising it again today.
Normally what happens in the House is that the political parties might want to do declaration. Because the division of revenue is a very straightforward document, they probably won't get debate, but they make a declaration. But those members, you know, we can't say to them they can't say anything in the House. Even if they will say something that may not be related to what we're doing, because when declarations are done, they may as well stand and say something. But maybe when we deal with that report, let's come and see it again. Because the difficulty is that, you know, we have no power to tell parties what to do. We can only note that they have standing apologies. As I can see today, there are apologies. In fact, we should note them. Is Honorable Mkwakwa, Honorable Karti, and we also have Honorable Nananga, I think, she's on sick leave. But the others are the standing ones that you are worried about, that they are never here. But they may want to say something on the budget. Let's talk about this later. Okay. Nomsa is ready for us. Let me welcome you and your team. If you do have a team, introduce yourself and your team so that we know who is here. The honorable members will introduce themselves as they ask for clarity and comment so you'll know who they are. But for now, we want you to introduce yourself and your team and then go through your presentation. You are most welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. My name is Woody Arut, and I'm the parliamentary officer for NUMSA, based here in Cape Town, in Spur Street. I don't have a team yet, eh? We did have a team last week because we anticipated that we were going to present on Friday, and we had the team come up from Johannesburg. It's a bit unfortunate because we brought them up actually on Tuesday so they could get familiar with the process and how the committee actually deals with these matters. But they had to return by Friday, so it would have been a lot of expense to actually get them down here. So I'm going to do the presentation, I must tend an apology on behalf of the team. We want to thank the committee for giving us the opportunity to come here and to make a presentation on the medium-term budget policy statement 2014. The presentation that we have, it's not a very long presentation, and I'm sure we'll probably able to do it long before 30 minutes, so that there could be some time for discussion. The other thing is this, is that the Congress of South African Trade Unions are also meant to be here today to present. And what I want to assure the House is that even though we are making separate presentations, the whole principle is that we are here to reinforce each other's presentations and not to cancel them out. So sometimes we ask, well, why is NUMSA coming with a separate presentation when the Federation is here? And doesn't the First Federation represent the views of everyone? And that is very true. I mean, sometimes we after consultation, we prefer making separate presentations and then to use these presentations to reinforce each other. So having cleared that, let me start. It's a very simple structure. There's no detailed graphs or tables. There's some work that has been done by our research department, and I'll go to that. But the structure is very simple, is that the introduction, in our introduction, what we want to say is that we, as NUMSA, we have a very, we think it's important that we have a human rights focus on the budget. We think that government policies of spending must at all times be fundamentally geared towards reducing unemployment, poverty, and inequality. So this, for us, it's really important to have a human rights focus, or as some call it, a human rights lens. What we've noted is that in this particular budget, that there is, and I think the contradictions are a bit glaring. We picked this up when the minister said, doing more with less, and we believe that doesn't really vindicate him when he says that the budget will not be balanced on the back of the whole. And this is the sort of contradiction that we find that runs consistently throughout the budget. The economic analysis is fairly simple. It's nothing elaborate. What our research team looked at was they looked at discrepancies between estimates and outcomes, and they did some calculations. We looked at the functional groups allocation and real growth of expenditure. So these were the focus areas. The one thing that they found and that made things a bit difficult was that the fact that the functional groupings had changed and the categories. So there were, in some cases, the overlaps. In some cases, the categories remained the same. But in some cases, there were some categories that were discarded altogether. So the changes in these functional groups have made it a bit difficult to actually do a thorough analysis or a comparison of previous, what are the previous estimates and so on. The bottom graph is fairly about government making their GDP, their forecast and their projections, and as opposed to what the real figures are. And the argument here is that if government continues to make forecasts which are higher than what the actual GDP figures are, it's obviously going to impact in the way you're going to distribute and allocate your resources. And I don't think there's any foolproof way of making these are forecasts, so you have to go by them. But what we found is that over the last few years is that the forecast that government has hasn't quite really met with the actual GDP figures. On comparable expenditure functions, Well, they just took the estimates and outcomes and look at the percentage differences. So I'm not going to go through the whole table. And I think the next few tables do more or less the same thing. Is that when you look at percentages, clearly there's very, very marginal increases in some, very, very marginal. And of course, there are some that show a negative action, show a negative drop in the actual outcomes. A concern has been underspending, because underspending does undermine service delivery and social prosperity in South Africa. And we looked at a recent report now, which was by Dawson and McLaren on launching the right of access to adequate housing in South Africa. And this was a report prepared these commissioned by the Studies in Poverty and Inequality Institute. And they argued that the Urban Settlement Development Grant, which came into effect in 2011, has seen major under-expenditure or under-utilization of allocated resources. Now, we've raised this once before, and this is a very important thing, is that because when we come as a union, and we've often been asked, well, why? You can't spend, the departments can't spend what they got. Why do you want more money? It's illogical. It's to say, like, you know, if I can't eat this plate of food, but I want to go for a second helping. So this came up, and this has come up repeatedly, and we've been asked this. It says, well, look, you're the union, you come here, and you say, this is a very tight budget, but yes, the examples of departments that cannot spend. But there is another argument to this, is that, and I think we have to pay careful attention to that. Underutilization or under-expenditure of finances doesn't necessarily mean that what is allocated is sufficient. There are other reasons. There are other reasons. Whether they have a good business plan and management, whether they are efficient. These are the kind of things that we... So you have to look at this very critically in that I don't just accept that under-expenditure necessarily means that the allocations are sufficient, because there are many arguments to this here. Function groups are the percentage of total expenditure spread over the medium-term expenditure framework. The direct, most of the directions show that they were a decline of you know, the percentage of total expenditure has actually declined. And what we found is that with the decreases, the only other thing that seems to have grown up is the debt-to-service cost. So the debt-to-service cost rise, but expenditure and all the other functional groups have actually come down. And if you look at the priorities, basic education, and you try to put them in some sort of numerical order, basic education, housing, health, social protection, and so on, is that we're not sure. How do you really balance they are extremely important social needs, and they carry huge implications for the development of our country. So, you know, the question that comes to mind is, and are we having the right set of policies? Are we putting the right set of policies in place? And this is a big debate, because there isn't one answer, and sometimes and. We also get this in that day. We tell the union, or the union be told, well, look, you'll come here and you'll make very ideological statements. These are not profoundly rooted or grounded in economic theory and so on. But that is not true. I think from a very lay perspective, we are able to look at it, and we are able to say whether these disbursements are adequate or not, and what kind of policy choices we should make. This was the function group's real growth. What the researchers mainly did here was to look at the figures minus inflation forecast over the next few years. And if you take off inflation, then the growth, the real growth is very, very little. You can't just adjust if the expenditure, you adjust it by inflation and you make this forecast. But if you take inflation out, the real growth is actually very little. Negative real growth means that expenditures will not keep up with inflation. Function groups losing in real money over the 3 years. Defense and space security, police services, general public services, economic infrastructure, and network regulation, rural development, and land reform. We feel that declined GDP growth coupled with lower real expenditure means this is not really a counter-cyclical budget, because in a counter-cyclical budget, you've got to put the state intervenes. But the state puts a huge injection, some kind of stimulus,
we don't think that this is a real conflict, although there are different views on this. So our concern, the next concern that we have was on the public radio. Now the public service is fundamental for future development. It's very important. We think that if you review the wage bill in the public sector, this will have a negative impact on job creation because it's one of the biggest employers in the country. We also need to ensure that positions that need to be filled in order to ensure that there's service delivery and so on, and that if we take vacant posts that need to be filled and if we have to cut that out, we'll have to freeze them. We don't think that's really going to help. If you consider the fact that with 25.5% unemployment, and if you look at the expanded definition, 36.8% of staff in Africa, withdrawing funding and freezing recruitment will worsen the situation. We have other policy concerns. On the tax reforms, well, we have to wait and see what comes up in terms of it, because the minister said there'll be more details in February. But we want to caution, because you have a threshold, and we have a threshold, and that threshold, and under that threshold, where you don't really pay any tax. And if you are thinking of expanding the tax base and lowering that threshold, there might be a lot of problems with that. There are other ways of tax reform that means there's a wealth tax and so on. I think that's come up in previous presentations. But we don't know what package the minister is going to come with. What package of reform is going to come with, because he says there will be more details in the February budget. We're going to talk about a bit on the sale of non-core assets, discrepancies in electricity pricing. This is a very, very important one for us. Health, what we call an attack on labor, because repeatedly these things about labor disruptions are coming up. Procurement, renewable energy, a little bit of corruption, job creation and the Employment Tax Incentive Act. And that's after that we will conclude. We will conclude by looking at what are some of the other policy options. Now, sale of non-core assets is a concern, because what are these non-strategic assets? We don't know. This is one way of privatizing, say, but we don't know. What criteria are they going to use to identify the non-strategic assets? We really don't know that at the moment. But we are concerned that this is probably bringing back a privatization back into discussion with labor. And now we are really worried about this. LOEs, how they've been functioning, they're spending a lot of money. A lot of that money is actually, what we've seen is that it's going out in the form of capital flows. It's going out of the country, purchasing huge, for instance, like Transnet, billions are being spent on acquiring stock, rolling stock and so on. A lot of money is going out, and very little is actually coming to local industries. Electricity pricing, this is a big concern. Nepal really is hard here. ESCOM versus municipality pricing. Now, we've got two systems of pricing in the country. That ESCOM has some who source the electricity directly from ESCOM, pay a particular tariff. Those that source from the municipalities pay, and sometimes it's not uncommon to find residents in a particular area on a particular street pay two different tariffs. One's paying ESCOM, and one's paying to that municipality. And there are huge discrepancies in those tariffs. And this is something that comes up very often. We've all talked about it with the Minister of Trade and Industry once. And there's got to be a harmonizing of tariffs. We've got to ensure that there's affordable electricity and that there's been a campaign to increase the amount of basic electricity. And we think it's important that... and not everybody actually enjoys that 50 kilowatts nowadays. I can tell you there are certain areas which are very middle income to higher income areas that get free, that even get the free basic electricity. Where there are many, many poor areas, and many areas where, like in the rules, where you can't really go, you've got to travel huge distances to actually apply for these things. So it doesn't really help when you have this thing distributed in a way where even those who can well afford it are also getting the 50 kilowatts an hour. The health concerns are non-negotiables. This is a huge problem for us. There has been a study again affecting the non-negotiable budget items in the provision of public health and HIV/AIDS services in South Africa. What they said is that they found in their studies that 4% is on spending on goods and services, and with 12% on personnel. This is a complete mismatch. If you spend more on one, which is like medicine and goods and services, it's totally inadequate if you have this mismatch when we have 30 problems around HIV, tuberculosis, and so on. And later, we've noticed this comment about when the minister in the MPD said, he did say that, look, when he looked at the country and the low, you know, that our performance in the economy hasn't been performing very well, and he listed out a number of reasons for this, the global economic downturn and so on. But he also listed that, well, labor disruptions. And of course, we've heard a lot about these labor disruptions. There's always reference to the mining strikes. There's been reference to the NUMSA engineering strike a few months ago and so on. But labor disruptions, we don't think it's really fair. The workers have their constitutional rights. They can engage in collective bargaining. If there are disputes, they can go, they have a process, and they have a legitimate right to strike. Now, if we keep raising that as labor disruption, what is a constitutional right, then we've got a problem. Then we have a problem. And we don't think this is, you know, by constantly referring to this thing, we have labor and the strikes. I think we must, the other reasons, the global downturn, the interest of capital and very powerful conglomerates, the fact that a lot of money actually flows out of this country. The exchange controls and so on, is that a lot of money is actually moving away. So we can't say. We think that if there are some structural changes, and then maybe we limit those outflows, and then there will be money in the country to meet the kind of sort of development needs that we've been talking about. The problem with procurements, we've had a lot of problems here. The Department of Trade and Industry and Treasury agree that national procurement policies and regulations are being flouted. Now, there's no dispute about that. What we would like to see the minister do is to take a harder stand on those who breach the procurement regulations. In a recent article appeared in Engineering News, Minister Davies indicated that he would like the Auditor General, flag as irregular expenditure any flouting of buy local procurement rules by government, departments, and state-owned companies. It remains to be seen what steps Treasury will implement to curtail what Minister Davies called irregular expenditure. Because there has to be some intervention from somewhere. If Treasury is not doing it, then Parliament must take a look at it. You can't, and I'm going to, when I talk about the renewables, and I talk about the investments that have been made there, and some of the flouting that's actually going on now, it's quite serious. We're having companies, they're setting up, becoming suppliers, they're sourcing from the outside. So we're not really seeing the procurement policies working the way they've been intended to work. With renewable energy, now, government has the program where they said 1 million solar water heaters by 2014. And in the beginning of the year, DOE reported 95,088 installations across all the provinces. This was when they briefed the Select Committee on Economic Development, 21st February 2014. So they gave a number there. It's like just about, it's not even halfway yet. We're not even halfway of the million, so that's like about 40%, or just under 40%. We've noted some of the policy instruments and what changes were made. They said a shift from a rebate or contract model. That would actually help the civil society speed up the localization of the industry and so on. They even went so far as DTI has designated solar water heaters, who have been designated as. But important components continue to flood the market. And Eskom once reported that in a matter of like 2 years or so, imports have scaled up from like 20-40%. They almost doubled in a matter of 2 years. So imports continue. At the end of January this year, we lost, and this is because of some of the uncertainties, we lost 60 workers at a company. You lose one worker, you're virtually losing, you know, a household. Now we lost 60 workers. And this is an industry that is beginning to grow. So it's growing slowly, but they're huge obstacles. And I think that part of the problem is that securing or actually putting into place the local content requirements and securing locally
it's not happening. Even though we had an assurance the government is moving from the rebate to bulk local procurement of solar water heaters as part of an effort to improve the localization component. So they changed the policy instrument from the rebate to the bulk. What they proposed was a contract model, which would want us to consolidate the industry, bigger volumes, and also give the industry a chance to bring in some of the smaller players. That hasn't happened. The REI, that Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Procurement Program, is a very long acronym. It's been highly ranked, and a lot of money has been put in here. There's a, if you take round 1, 2, and 3, there's something like a 120 billion worth of investments. A lot of that's domestic investments, but also for this order. But, and here's something that I found very, very disturbing. I was at the Wind Indaba for 2 days. In fact, the Wind Indaba is still on. It finishes today. And yesterday, at a plenary on the REI PPP, you had a discussion, and unfortunately, it didn't allow any space for the discussion to really move to the floor because of the limited time. So, you had all the independent power producers sitting in a row. And eventually, it had to be said. And this is what one of them said. He said, our power business is to build wind farms, produce electricity, not socio-economic development. So government must draw a line when this obligation ends. I couldn't believe he said this. But as an independent power producer, these sentiments of his was echoed by everybody else. And of course, there were very few labor people here, and very few representations from, although we had a community side event. But this is saying it very, in a very open, candid manner. Because the problem here is that the REIPPP was put on the table, and the government's flagship renewable energy program, there will be a lot of, it's going to create this number of jobs, the localization of industry is going to help, in fact, increase our capacity to produce components and so on for this particular industry, the different renewable energy technology. But round 1, 2, and 3 have been big consortiums. They're big consortiums. And many of them, who are, in fact, all the technology, almost all the companies that were there, all main foreign-owned companies, wind turbines, towers, blades, and so on, the technology, one is that they said, given the urgency of demand, and this is fine for them because they said, given the urgency of demand, we have to import the stuff. So we can't, which I can accept for round 1, maybe 2, but they're not really looking at about how do we localize this industry. Of course, they're looking at, yes, South Africa might be a good place to start because it gives them a springboard to enter into the rest of Africa. But they're busy looking at these options. They're still busy looking at these options. But the other disturbing fact about this is that, and this came up from the chairperson of SAWIA, you know, he made a side remark, but a Spanish company, SAWIA, doesn't want to use local drivers. They want the drivers of the trucks to come from Spain. Not here. And he said this in a side remark at the plenary session yesterday. From discussions on the floor when we briefed, we also learned that very specialized equipment, some equipment like tools and all of that which they use. There are some firms that are here, local suppliers, but the Spanish firms are saying, no, we are going to source the tools from our own country, and they are hiding these tools, going to use them, and then send them back. There isn't really a strong commitment to localization. The only time they'll probably move on localization or a strong commitment to that is that, and they've been repeatedly saying this for the 2 days, is that they want certainty from government. They want certainty that the demand, on the demand side, that actually says, well, look, it's worth our coming here and setting up. Now, we admit, we can see that some of these industries are very expensive, the capital that you need to actually set them up and all of that. But they're looking for much more. So the 3,725 megawatts that was allocated in the first round, and further 3,200, out of those book allocations, 200 has been allocated for small projects. But even there, they haven't really got
round one has they come in two parts. Round one for the small bit between 1 and 5 megawatts comes in two parts, and we are round two, but these are very small projects. They can still be a bit costly, but they are small projects, but very, very elaborate processes of tendering and bidding. I'm not going to spend too much time here, but I think when we talk about renewables, when we talk about our energy, a lot of talk about Eskom, a lot of talk about our fuel and fossil-based industries and so on, renewables has been expanding at a rapid pace globally. We think there's huge scope here for actually creating, and South Africa can play a pioneering role here in taking up renewables, but it's not going to come just by dishing out the contracts. And even though the one newspaper resource reported $10 billion worth of investment, and I mean, a lot of that's going to go out there. But it's not really going to stay there. It's there, but they buy technology, they buy equipment, components, skills, so on, and that will go out again. Crime and corruption, well, this is corruption. We picked up figures on them. They said that there were 5,485 reports of arrest corruption received since the organization was launched in January 2012. 2,262 reports were received in 2013, and there's a marked improvement in overall reporting quality. The report highlighted corruption in government, as well as the top four sectors in corruption reports. Schools topped the list, and then irregularities in the procurement process, embezzlement of funds, school governing body, maladministration, and corruption in government have put our schools at risk. And they give out a breakdown, corruption in government by tiers of government, local, provincial, so on. Now, I'm not to say these are correct figures or they're incorrect figures, but this is from the kind of research. This is obviously an organization that had the resources to do this kind of research, and this is coming from Corruption Watch, and there's the breakdown by sector. I'm getting close to finishing up now. On the ETIA concerns, now, on Tuesday the 23rd of September, 2014, representatives from Treasury briefed the Public Finance Monetary Policy Chamber and the Labour Market Chamber in NEDLAC. Now, I can report on this because a colleague of mine sits in the Labour Market Chamber in NEDLAC. And they reported on the Employment Tax Incentive Act. And what Treasury reported was that they gave a figure of 211,000 jobs. Now, we've seen from this year, early in the year, it was something like 53. In the State of the Nation address in June, it went to 133 somewhat. But anyway, the figure that you're now getting from Treasury is 211,000 jobs. It's become clear, however, that this was by own admission and an estimate. What Treasury did was took tax information and divided the retained tax by the number of applications. They then reported that this came from a monthly form that employees complete, and they believe they'll get more information from the biannual tax return. But they said there's a lot of things that they can't really say. One is the issue of confidentiality. They spoke about deadweight jobs. Now, deadweight jobs, what it really means is jobs that would have been created anyway. And they gave a ratio of 2:1. If you take a ratio of 2:1 to 211,000 jobs, then that's roughly something like about 140-some-odd to 70-some-odd jobs. So 2:1, right? So for every two deadweight jobs that would have been created anyway, one job comes up. So you probably end up looking at, well, then it may be. And this is their estimate. How many beneficiaries have really benefited from that and the 2,000 rand or so on you're giving as an incentive? It probably comes down to around 75,000. But these are figures, and what Treasury did was present these things, and they weren't able to really quantify a lot of this stuff. So they talked about estimates, they talked about problems that they had. They couldn't answer on the uptake by labor brokers. Yes, they said, look, they don't, yes, the uptake by labor brokers that have been mainly using these incentives, or taking advantage of these incentives. And they said, well, look, it's not something that they desire, but the law allows that. I mean, you can't reconstruct it. And they said they spent something like 1.2 billion after August 2014. And that's a lot of money that could also be in the fiscus. And depending whether you agree that we should have this incentive or not. Right. That's South Africa's quarterly labor force survey results. And this is, again, our research department picked this up. That if there's been a rise in unemployment amongst the youth, they looked at the stats reports. And the stats report, even though it doesn't measure employment of people from 18 to 29 years, that's a requirement for the ETIA, It captures employment data of those aged between 15 to 24, and I think 24 to 34. And it doesn't show any significant rise in the employment. In fact, actually what it shows is that unemployment in this category had actually gone up, has increased. So we're grappling with a situation here where we're trying to make an assessment of this. Is this really working, or is it a failed solution? Is it a solution that's not? I mean, it's a possible, it's a solution, but it's a failed, it's a false solution. It's not really helping us out of the situation that we are in. The other area we want to touch on is the rating agencies. The country seems to go into a state of panic every time Moody's or Standard. Every time, but the point is that who's calling the shots? The rating agencies, and there's an article that says they're keeping a keen watch on South Africa. What's our own sovereignty? What's our own policy space? Every time there's a rating agency, so it's not the World Bank or International Monetary Fund, it's the rating agencies. So our policy choices are influenced by international money lenders. And it's blackmail. This is blackmail. Why don't we use some of our resources to leverage it the other way around? Always. We've got to be very careful here. We've got to be very careful what we say. The rating agencies are watching us. Yet we never use our own resources in the country to leverage this the other way around. It's always what they say, and when they do this, and we play by this tune, we are held to ransom. We found, and we take a little bit of inspiration from this, that the United Nations Office of Trade and Trade Development, in their report 2013, in their latest report 2014, they made some very profound statements about growth and development. They said, yes, almost everywhere in recent years, the spread of market liberalism has coincided with highly unequal patterns of income and wealth distribution. A world which 85 wealthiest citizens own more than its bottom 3.5 billion was not the one in visit 50 years ago. And this is from the UNCTAD report. It's worrying. The extremes, on one side, the extremes amount of accumulation and wealth, and then the other side, you have all these very, very poor, unequal distribution of wealth and resources. So they also propose some policy choices. We never really found our government engaged with these policy choices. We found that they were aligned to the International Monetary Fund and so on. The UNCTAD policy choices, they said, look, if you want to balance those scenarios, there are things that you have to put in place. One, you have to have income policy to support growth of demand on a sustainable basis, so you don't cut income. We shouldn't be talking about wage restraints. Growth-enhancing fiscal policies, now this is not growth-enhancing fiscal policies that we've had here in the MTBS. Investment policies to promote investment in structural transformation. Regulation of systematically important financial institutions and capital control to stabilize those financial markets. Especially thinking about capital flows. And development trade or development-oriented trade agreements. We've got to open up the policies for debate. We've got to do that. We can't go with blinkers onto one set of policy instruments. We do that, we're going to run into a logjam. And that's more or less where I'd like to conclude, Mr. Chairperson. I don't have anything else, and I think we are going to wait to see what the February budget, whether there's going to be any changes, any shifts again in those allocations, and then perhaps we'll probably come back next year when the big budget is announced. So thank you for giving us this opportunity once again to make this presentation.
Thank you very much, Woody Aron. Honorable members, that's the presentation. I'll now allow you to ask for clarification, make comments from the presentation from NUMSA. Honorable Sheikh.
Thank you. I am A.M. Sheikh Imam, a member of this committee. Thank you. First of all, let me take this opportunity of thanking you for the presentation. I'm going to start off with my first question, probably an unusual one. In light of the fact that you are an affiliate of COSATU, and I think you did try to do that in the beginning, and you obviously have liberated a different organization affiliated to COSATU. And COSATU is coming to do a presentation. It would be my view that all these issues would have already been tabled with COSATU, and as such COSATU is going to come and do a collective presentation in terms of all that you have identified. So I'm not sure whether it's really a duplication or not. But I would imagine that as an organization that you are affiliated to, you know, it would make, for me, it would be more valuable that if it had put all your efforts and all your considerations together and then came up with one, would probably help, and then came with a bigger delegation and maybe then, you know, one day. But let me start off then by saying, in terms of, I see we talk about the unemployment rate increase. NUMSA are not satisfied in terms of the incentives, the youth subsidy first of all fund, in terms of the government policy on manufacturing industries and the incentives to the textile labor industry in trying to create employment. Are they not satisfied that to a certain extent government is looking at these issues and making some effort to try and change that and reduce the unemployment rate? That is my first one. The second one is that in terms of the deficit, government, we speak about the government level of reducing the deficit, and the reason for that is to try and reduce the debt service costs. Now, in reducing the debt service cost, would that not mean more money will then be available to deliver to the people that are in the most needed areas? That is my second one. You are aware, obviously, as NUMSA, that mechanisms, even Treasury for that matter, consistently come out with wherever they find loopholes. And yes, we would agree that there is fraud, there is corruption, there is maladministration, there is wasteful expenditure. Yes. And efforts are being made. You know, when somebody wants to commit fraud, they will find a way. Then you find that loophole, you close it. Then they'll find another loophole. And that seems to be happening all the time. But Treasury, as you pick them up, and as a member of this committee, we find that Treasury is closing those gaps, and that's why you would see the reduction on the fraud and in terms of the figures that you get from corruption, you see that there's a vast improvement. Is that not saying that, yes, that it's working, that something at least working, that we are being able to reduce the fraud and corruption at that level? I'm not saying that it's our satisfaction. The attempts are being made to move in that direction and try and eradicate, because yes, fraud, corruption, that is a major contributing factor to the challenges that we face. Let me just, Chair, you can stop me if you think I'm taking too many things. NUMSA, I want to know, you know the challenges that are faced by the people in South Africa. What is NUMSA as an organization doing to be able to assist? Because, you know, we also talk about imports, and yes, imports is flooding the market, there is no doubt, and that is having a bearing on us, because as a result of the cheap imports, all the industries are starting to close down. I don't know what recommendations NUMSA would have made in terms of that in the past, and I believe that you have a platform to be able to do that so that you can address these issues. But my concern is it not the case that the demand from labor is sometimes extravagant or so large that it is having an impact on local industry? As a result, people are now importing, businesses and factories, and manufacturing industries all closing down. The other thing is that I want to know is there too much of an expectation that everything must come from government, must do this, government must do that, government must do that? I'm a little bit concerned about that, because I also believe that as organizations we should also play some kind of a role in trying to cement that, and where there are challenges, I would believe that maybe we need to come in and say, let's sit down and find solutions, because where problems, you can continue with problems, you don't find solutions, they're never going to disappear. So I'd like to know, what would you as NUMSA believe? Because I gather that in terms of what you're saying, you don't have any confidence in a lot of the policies. You believe there are a lot of challenges. You don't believe that the vision of the revenue bill is an ideal option. You've got the challenges, but had NUMSA, but something that you can tell us that you believe that is different in the way we should bring, have you perhaps interacted on that level to be able to put in different options that you believe might be viable and different that might actually work? You do appreciate that globally there is, of course, an economic downturn. There is the GDP growth has been declining. So that effect is here as well in South Africa. We have serious challenges there that over and above, you talk about crime and all the different issues. But yes, they are realistic issues. But one cannot expect too much too soon. I believe that we are doing something. Mechanisms are being put in place. The opinions and comments and interactions, all the different stakeholders is important, is relevant, and that should be done regularly so that we can bring about and help each other to be able to find solutions in this. In terms of well, I think we have spoken about the unemployment rate. Okay, if you want me to stop and let somebody else and then come back, I don't have a problem. So, okay, thank you.
Good morning. My name is Michael Figa. I'm a member of the Standing Committee on Appropriations. Just a few comments. I obviously cannot defend the minister because he's the one that made these suggestions and proposals, but I just have a few comments on your inputs, starting with the slide number 14. Right, the second bullet point, you mentioned in the presentation that reducing the waste bill in the public sector will have a negative effect on job creation. Now, yeah, that is partly true, I believe, as long as the state is the main provider of jobs. But, you know, in your presentation, you also talk about private investment as well. So I believe that, if you rely too much on the state, then that would be true. But I think the private investors also need to be encouraged to invest in the economy. The slide number 15, issue there, you just comment there, a statement made that, which I find very interesting, sorry for that, is that there's little corruption. I don't know, I think if you call 30 billion then yeah, little corruption, then yeah, maybe we have different views on what is little. The other, on slide number 17, I'm just a little concerned, and again, I wouldn't probably get some support with regards to the last bullet points in your proposal there, talking about increasing the free electricity. You know, this is the problem in our country. We have so much free stuff here. We borrow it to sustain the social or to give free services, etc. And now we already cannot afford what we've got at the moment. And now we're looking at increasing more. So in my view, I believe we should rather reduce rather than increase. So I'm not in favor of that one. And I'm probably going to get a bit of flack for it, but that's fine. I'm not here to make sense. Slide number 19. You talk in isolation about labor disruptions. I don't think that's really the issue. I think the issue is more your violent, protracted labor disruption. That's what has an effect on the economy. So it's not, you're right, of course labor disruption is part of the basic or labor relations act, but when you talk about the violent and the perspective, that's really the ones that create problems. And then, slide number 26, there's a suggestion from yourself about instead of worrying about external, you talk about on the one hand about the global market, but then on the other hand, you talk about not relying on external sources of funding and rather relying on internal. And again, we have a problem. I mean, we cannot balance the budget, so therefore we need to rely on external sources. So we don't have our own resources to fund whatever our needs are
internally. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
Thank you,
Chairperson. And thanks, Member, for the presentation. I've got only maybe one or two questions. You said as Member, you proposed that you maybe even ensure affordable electricity on slide number 17. I just want to check, how are you going to do this? You said. And then on slide number 20, you said as Minister would like to see Minister and take a harder stance on those who breach procurement regulations. What do you think a harder stance will be? Because I think the laws are there to guide those who are doing the whole thing. I'll tell it there now. Thank you.
Okay, Honorable Microphone.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. No, also, I wanted to check around the concern of Musa on the issue of...
Your mic on.
Yeah, and the concern of Musa on the issue of freezing the post that has been standing there for a long time, as the Minister has proposed it, or as part of the medium-term budget policy statement, is a concern. But I want to check, because I think my colleague Faye has alluded to this, what is the role of the union, or NUMSA in particular, and the other union around the issue of making sure that their members are performing in a way that it's not going to give a challenge that we have today of the posts that are not yet being filled? Because these are your members that have not done that. Because it tends to say that everything that is wrong is when the government is trying to act. But we don't hear what is it that we are doing to encourage your members to really perform in the way that is expected so that they can prevent that. Secondly, don't you think that on the proposal of the minister, there is a provision of what you have raised to say that maybe because you indicated that even though they are under expenditure or not, the money not spent, but it doesn't mean that it's enough. You know, we must consider that, I think, as a committee. But don't you think that in that particular matter of the positions that are going to be scrapped, there is a provision that the minister has made in that particular, in the statement to say that exceptions on page 23, exceptions would be considered for critical positions with the owners on the department to justify exception. Because if the department is not, the minister is not just says that, no, we are just pressing, but there is consideration that will be made, you know. But if there is a problem of the responsible people to fill in the post and they are not also motivating, I don't think it will be responsible government if they can just keep the money that can be used somewhere for the position. I don't think what will be your comment on that one. Do you think if the positions are not filled, money must still be kept and not be used somewhere, even though they don't motivate to say that, because Minister has made a provision on that one to say that it's not just a blanket thing. There will be a consideration on the particular matter. And also, I think on the issue of corruption, the Honourable Member covered me that I wanted to comment on. And also, you have indicated, you have raised a concern also around the issue of the proposal for the fiscal policy framework by the Minister. But what I want to check, because the intention of the minister on page 2 of the MTDPS is to narrow the deficit. Is precisely to narrow the path of debt. What I want to check from NUMSA, is it not appropriate, it is not inappropriate to allow a growing path of debt through the rising deficit when the economy is struggling to grow, as this may result in an increase in debt service costs. And such increase may result in more money being invested in the payment for the debt instead of the basic service delivery. Have you ever considered that? What is your comment on this, on the particular matter? Thank you.
Thank you, Honor. Followed by Honor. Yeah, thanks, Jefferson. Just two or three quick questions. I don't know whether NUMSA has noticed that the cut in the budgetary allocations has only been suggested for the national at the national sphere of government, the 6.2 billion rand. But if you look at the budget, the whole of it, you notice that there are no cuts. The two lower spheres of government, and in my view, that does speak to the minister's assertion that the budget will not be balanced on the back of the poor at two levels. The first being that clearly government wants to maintain an increase and improve service delivery at lower levels of government, and that's why there are no cuts at the two lower spheres of government. At the same time, there is no suggestion that there are cuts at the level of there are cuts on social security, which then suggests to me that there's a real possibility of us being able to grow provincial and local economies and create jobs at that level. I don't know whether NUMSA has had a look at that and has realized that in fact what we need to do a lot more is focus on provincial government, local government, improved service delivery, economic development at local level, and job creation. That's the first thing which I'd like NUMSA to comment about. The second part, Shepherd, is in fact, if you look at the medium-term budget estimates between 2015 to 2018, there is actually a steady increase in the proposed allocation. So that it doesn't look to me like this is a fiscal contractionary fiscal policy in the broad sense, but rather it emphasizes issues relating to efficiency, avoiding wastage, maladministration, and so on. But notice also that there are allocations focusing on increasing capacity at local government level, at municipal government level, which seeks to improve that area of performance of government. So in a way, the minister does say to us, and in fact the government does say to us, Don't ask for more money where you can, you, when you can't spend. The issue, for instance, you are raising about the vacancy. The president made this call in the Ford administration, I think it was 2011, that all vacancies must be filled, funded vacancies must be filled. 6 years down the line, those vacancies have not been filled. And the question we must ask is, does the public service really need those posts? Because they are funded, but they are not being filled. And the question can't be, we are not filling posts because we can't find the relevant skills. It's not possible that that could be the answer. Of course, we would know that there might be skills at the technical level, but broadly speaking, government can't give that answer that it can't deploy because they are not this. Because it has responsibility to create skills. Which says to us, probably the minister is right to say, now let's look at these vacancies that have been that are funded but have been lying vacant for a good couple of years now. And actually review and assess whether we need these vacancies or not. And in fact, force departments to begin to say, what are the relevant skills that we need? Where can we find them? How do we fill these posts? And how do we fund, create these posts, fund them, and actually fill these posts? So that you actually not downscale on employment, on job creation in the public service, but rather look for relevance, whose aim is to achieve a developmental capable state. I think that is the thrust of the matter. I don't know whether you are looking at it from that side, and therefore, if we could at some point begin to look at that and tease out further ways of addressing the NUMSA concern at the level of job creation, but government concern at creating a credible developmental state, and therefore reviewing the issue of vacant posts that are funded but lying unfilled. Thank you, Chair. But one more thing, which is not part of the presentation, which perhaps we might want to look at, Chairperson. Not only with NUMSA, but together with COSATU. There was a report about a week or so ago, which says that there are 20.1 million people who are now economically active in South Africa's economy. But we have the unemployment problem. Perhaps the researchers must begin to revisit that area. I'm not speaking about our researchers here. I'm speaking about independent researchers out there, including the Federation researchers. That's one. And then goes on to say, union membership has increased by 22%. So what does that mean when we are talking about economic growth, high unemployment, but there is this outcome of this? I'm saying, person, I'm raising this issue. It's an issue that COSATU generally, I hope they are here now, and ourselves will have to look at in the future. I'm raising it and I'm putting it on the table so that we have a real look at what do we really have in our economy. Honorable,
thank you, Honorable Chairperson. My name is Alan McLaughlin. I'm a member of the Senate Committee on Appropriations. Mr. Haroon, thank you for your presentation. There's a lot in there that I agreed with and would support, but I also found a few what I would refer to as anomalies, I guess, even contradictions. Perhaps you could comment on those for me. Can I ask you, slide number 8, just for your definition of what you mean by social prosperity. I wasn't quite sure what you were referring to in that statement. I can take you forward to, much has been said already about public political concerns, and we've had several discussions around this aspect. My colleagues here already addressed the issue as well. On the point, though, that if one segment of the economy stops employing, surely that would encourage job seekers to look in other sectors of the economy. So while it might bring to a stop recruitment in one sector, it's surely going to boost it in another sector. Because people still look for jobs, and if they know there are no jobs available in one sector, they're going to look for them somewhere else. So I'm not sure that I agree with that point. Your sale of non-core assets concern, you don't specifically say whether you're in favour of this or not. I gather from what you say in your slide that you're not in favour of it. You say there are no non-strategic assets. And then you say that then there's less control over pricing. That seems to me to be a contradiction in terms. If you want prices to be controlled, but you don't want wages to be capped, surely the one goes with the other. If you're going to cap wages, then have price controls. If you're not going to cap wages, then take away price controls, and there would be a free market. Surely you're going to have one that favours the worker, the one that sort of disfavours those who sell the goods into the market. It must be a fair playing field, surely. If I relate that slide, that's slide number 16, to slide number 26 as well. Our policy is influenced by international money lenders as background. I also need to relate that to some others. Because at the moment we have a position where there's a deficit that has to be funded. That's why there's been a reduction of 6.2 million rand in the budget, and over the next 2 years a further 25 million rand will be reduced off the projected outer year budgets. This money has to be funded from somewhere. Now, you say on the one hand you don't want to sell core assets or non-strategic assets, we must use our own resources, but if we're not going to sell them, what are we going to do with them? We need to raise the money somehow. So we either sell those resources and generate money there, or we go outside and borrow money from whoever's got the money. Those people who are going to lend us the money, they look at things like, what's the credit rating? What are our chances of getting our money back? Anybody who's investing money wants a return on his investment. So, while yes, you might see it as blackmail, if we tailor our policies in such a way that we want to encourage investors, I hardly see that that's where we're sort of playing to their tune. They've got the money. If we want to borrow it from them, then we have to comply with whatever conditions they may impose. Those conditions get progressively worse as our economy performance gets worse. The two go hand in hand. Which brings me to your slide number 19, where you say that you take exception to the remark that labour disruptions are amongst the reasons for our poor economic growth rate. It's unfortunately a fact. Now, to say it, I don't know why you take exception to the fact that when it's mentioned, you say you take exception to it. It is one of the reasons why we have to downgrade growth rates, because of what's been going on in the labour market. That's what these outside people look at. It's part of why we get a downgrade. It's not the only reason I accept. It certainly is a reason. It also seems to argue against your point that, well, how do we fix this? I don't see any answer in your comments. You make a lot of statements, as I say, many of which I agree with, but I don't see anything coming from you as to how we resolve these issues. If we're going to just sort of follow the union line, it doesn't tell me where we're going to get the money to pay for all this. It's all sort of very much in favour of the unions, but not in favour of anybody else, and I don't know where the money is going to come from. So perhaps a good comment on that for me. Your issues with the procurement problems, I agree 100%. Buy South Africa and support our local economy. But in many instances we don't have a choice, because there's nobody in our market who can produce the goods we want, and that's when we have to go outside, and then we're subject to whatever terms and conditions are imposed upon us. I think that's the same thing that relates to your comment about the Spanish company who wants to import Spanish drivers. Well, I'd like to think if it was a South African company and Spain competing for a tender, we'd say the same thing, looking after our own. It's hardly surprising. It's obviously up to us whether we impose conditions on them or not. We'll say, no, you can't do that. So I understand what they're saying. Your comment from the wind in Darba, I think you're missing a point, with all due respect. They said our core business is to build windmills and generate electricity. Surely if that wasn't the case, we wouldn't be talking to him in the first place, because that's what we want from him, is to build the windmills and produce electricity. Surely we want those we're dealing with to have an interest in their core business. They're saying it's not their core business to produce social equality, and we have to accept that. It must be an element of the contract, but not their core business. Otherwise, why would we be talking to him in the first place? And lastly, your slide 24 about your ETIA concerns, I wasn't quite sure of the context of what you're saying, and maybe you could just elucidate that a little for me. So the 211,000 jobs, in what context is that? I wasn't quite sure. Thank you. Thanks, Gary.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Sheila Shopetitole, and I am very grateful that you managed to come, and I hope you will be here when COSATU actually give their input, because I think you actually said there will be similarities. I'll be interested in those similarities and supporting one another. I think to me that is very important. I just want to say that, you see, the question of fighting crime is a problem that actually government worries about and all of us worry about. But my understanding is that this happens within the public sector and the private sector. And I would like to know what is it that you can advise as a union. How are we going to deal with it? Because, you know, my understanding is that civil servants don't just wake up in the morning and go out in the street and become corrupt. It's people coming to the offices of civil servants and corrupt them. And these civil servants, I think, they are members. And we would like to know what is it that you can assist us with, how are we going to deal with. And I would also like to hear you talking also of the corruption in the private sector itself. You know, in the fourth parliament, we had a lot of cases appearing in the Competition Commission because of private sector commission. And if we want to build the economy of this country, let's talk about all our problems, not just one sector government, and we say nothing about the private sector, because they all impact on the lack of economic growth. The funding of polls, my colleague says, spoken about that, but I respect, you know, me being a rural woman at home. If I don't have money to buy mealy meal, I will do everything. I will even go to the neighbor and ask. I will even stop buying things like margarine or fish oil and just concentrate on the meal. We have got a problem. We don't have enough resources to fund our program. And there is money seated. People have budgeted for that money. And Parliament has agreed and allocated that money. But it's seated there. People are not feeding the post. And we cannot go out of this country and go and borrow for why we could first use the money that we have got that are not being utilized. I suspect when we are having this situation because those posts were not essential. If they were essential, they would have been filled. But the minister has been very considerate in making that statement, that the department will go and make a presentation to say that no, this one we are going to fill in the near future or something like that. So I wouldn't think you should worry a lot about that one. I agree with you. I don't like this rating agency that is talking us down. And I would like you at some other time to have a discussion with ourselves on how can we deal with this one. Because they give me such a headache. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to allow Nomsa to respond. Maybe let me just say that you are the chapter, Alan. So there is an opportunity to engage with Nomsa more frequently to you. Because what I want us to do is that some of the questions that members have asked, we can actually respond in IT. And also to allow members, if they haven't gone through a presentation and still want follow-up questions, they can email you so that we are able to gauge before we finalize the report. Because we are not finalizing our report to the National Assembly today. It's probably the appropriation bill in the week time. So, if you can respond to everything in details, we will appreciate responses in writing so that we are able to consider this matter seriously. But let me allow you to then respond. There were a lot of issues raised, and as I said, some can come back to us in writing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. There's quite a lot of questions and some comments, and I think there's some overlap as well. So I will try and deal with some of the issues, and I'll try and go to them in some form of sequence, but some of them, I probably wouldn't go and touch on them because of these overlaps. And I think I'll mention that where I've sensed that there already is some overlap in the questions or comments. The first one was that, and why I'm not sitting here as a facade to affiliate and make one sort of consolidated collective response. There's a bit of history to this, is that one is that not all unions have parliamentary offices. That doesn't mean they can't respond to budgets, but they're not in a position to do that. The history has been that there used to be this, we used to have this. It used to come under the banner of what was called PBC, the People's Budget Coalition. And that was made up of COSATU, the non-governmental organizations, and the churches, and the South African Council of Churches. That seems to have withered away a bit. And I think over the last 2 years, there hasn't really been a consolidated approach to this. But I take point, and I do think sometimes helps to strengthen by making one presentation, and you have a whole lot of ancillaries or mixtures from the other affiliates to beef up what is in the report or in the response. There was issues that you raised about our high unemployment rate and that the incentives is the measure to try and reduce those employment rates. Now, I can only speak for Nomsaya, is that we were the only affiliate. And that we did present last year when we at the public hearing our views on the bill, and when the bill became an act, we were the only union that actually lodged a Section 77 application through NEDLAC, stating our opposition to the what was then now become an act, and we didn't, and we were not able to get to any sort of consensus with the respondents who are Treasury on this matter. Of course, it remains and it's something that we continuously try to monitor. But given that you have this high unemployment, I mean, we don't think it's just through incentives that you can sort out your unemployment problem. Unemployment is a structural problem. It's a much more wider economic implications here about choices that you make. But we do believe that, and we're a manufacturing union. We've said as a manufacturing union that we do support, and we do try to play an active role in this, in that one is that if we take our mineral resources, for instance, we long argued and championed for beneficiation policy that would have and that would be able to give positive results. But when we responded to the mineral resources and petroleum development Amendment Act. We supported the Section 26, which called for, and there was a Section 26 which actually called for where the minister would have more powers to designate certain strategic minerals and so on, and called for what is called a discounted price on. And if you have that, and particularly with the steel industry, which and you have a lot of ancillary downstream industries that feel that, so the issue of pricing was a big issue, because the issue of pricing in this country has been, and historically it's been one of what they call IPB, that's import currency pricing, which includes a lot of other costs which are not there, the tariff costs, the customs, and transport, and so on. But we said, look, if that discounted price include designation would help speed up the development of our downstream industries, that would really certainly take help one to beef up our industrial development. Two, it would lead to a lot of job creation. But we never get a second round on this. It went through to the National Assembly, they hate Section 26. And they changed it. And from one of the cabinet-approved decisions for a discounted price, and that was actually mooted by the DTI, they changed that to what is now called an EPP, an export currency price. An export currency price is the other side of the coin of the IPP. An export currency price is, it's a price that, what they call a mine gate price. It's a price that it's transport and tariff costs and so on. But it's still a market price. It's still a market price. Now, we don't think that's going to help speed up beneficiation. We have differences on that. We raised that the strategic question with Minister Davis about a month or two ago. And we know the lobbyists, the strong lobbyists that actually came for this market-based price for the Chamber of Mines, who were supported by the big mining conglomerates. So the issue of beneficiation is still very much a disputed thing in our view. We need to beneficiate. But how do we do that, and how do we ensure that the proper policy instruments are being used is a debatable issue. And this is something we couldn't get. So, there are many ways of tackling unemployment. And one of the ways is that we have to build a sound industrial base. You did mention things about the deficit and that we shouldn't have been here. It's very different. Running a country, not exactly the same as running a house, although you've got to, if you overspend, you get into trouble, you underspend, and you're going to have all sorts of other problems. There are differences. But we had a debate last week, and I think this is when the Parliamentary Budget Office was here, and they were giving some views on fiscal spending. And they were talking about highly industrialized countries like the US and all of that, with a very high deficit. Questions were posed as well. Why are we so constrained? Can we not? I'm not an economist, so I don't have all the answers for these things. But I think the thing is this, is that we take a point that it is, yes, if you're overspending, you're getting problems, but if we don't spend enough, we still have problems, because then there'll be a lack of service delivery and so on. But we've got to have growth. We've got to, for 20 years now, 20 years since our democracy, we've got to see expansion. We've got to see more people employed. But not just employed. We've got to see that employed in good, sustainable, decent jobs, and so on. Mechanisms, rules on the corruption issue you raised, we acknowledge that government has put measures and steps in place, and we acknowledge that. We just think that, corruption watch says that, look, yes, we acknowledge it. It's good that government has put measures in place, but we also got to make sure that people don't get away just because they have the right political questions. It's an important thing. It's an important thing. I think we've got to see how we deal with that. The demand of labor extravagance, I'm not sure what is extravagant. I mean, we have, currently we have on the table, and this is subject to debate now, the question of a national minimum wage. The Portfolio Committee on Labor has actually started some of the engagements on that. They're now going out in public hearings. They haven't really put an official response on the table of labor, because they haven't called us yet. But we have been attending some of these public hearings, and there's a debate on that. We don't think labor is a core big extravagant. I think if we look at these stats and stats for Africa, what it will show you is that more than 50% of workers in this country, the employer decides their wages. They're not union negotiated or individually negotiated. If you look at how remuneration is sourced and how remuneration is negotiated in this country, stats of Africa will actually give you a very good picture.
They'll tell you what percentage of what is, where the employer decides what you get. You have absolutely no say in the matter. How much of it is negotiated by bargaining councils? How much of it is negotiated by the individuals themselves with the employer? So it's not as if everybody in the country negotiates through trade unions. I think it's a very small percentage, actually. Right? By far, most of us don't actually negotiate their wages. The employer decides. So we've got to ensure that, you know, we think that there are measures and mechanisms of the LRA and so on and all the other supporting legislation in place to avoid, and try and avoid exploitation, but we do have a very huge informal labor market. Lots of workers are casualized. These issues, and what are the kind of institutions that address these issues? These issues do go to NEDLAC. Anything of a socio-economic nature has to go to NEDLAC. But NEDLAC can't come up with all the answers. So we've got to try and find, there's got to be more policy spaces of how we deal with this. Very quickly, I think Honorable Malcolm Figg has made a number of comments. He doesn't agree with us. He feels that free electricity now, we should cut it down. But you've got to understand that there was a mandate in this country. From 1994 to now, we've had different policy instruments in place. We've had different policy frameworks in place. I think access to electricity has increased, access to water has increased, but if it becomes very expensive, then you're going to have disconnection. So we're going to see a figure of access, and that's going to be, say, look, so many people now have access to electricity, so many people now have access to water. We have to counterbalance that with those who are disconnected from these services. The labor issue, and I think this has come up from several people here, is that you've got to understand what is our constitutional right. Is that labor, we have a right to bargain. We have a right to engage in collective bargaining. We have a right to strike. You can't pin, if you go on a legally protected strike, you cannot pin the duration of the strike. The strike is, well, one of the two is sooner or later, whether the trade-offs are made earlier, whether the trade-off take aid. We don't know. It's your bargaining power. So you can't pin what the duration of the strike is. If you try to do that through what the Australians are doing, through what they call compulsory interest arbitration and so on, and say, well, you only can do this up to this point, we're going to have problems. We're going to have serious problems. We don't know. The DLA has been signed. Amendments have been made. It's been signed. But we're hearing these, well, I don't know whether to call them whispers or what, but every now and then you see the paper, some government official saying something. You have laws in the country. If it is violence, you have criminal laws in the country that can deal with this. So we can't say labor disruption, violence, but you have laws to deal with these. Why are we making such a big issue about this? Yes, you feel the rating agencies must be there. They're there. We can't really do much about them. These are international agencies. They decide. They decide our interest rates, whether we're going to pay more, whether we're going to pay less, what. They're there. But we just have far too much in terms of our policy space. We've got to find ways of how do we leverage our own resources here. Now, we're not speak about that because not so long ago, in fact, it was just a few other days, there was a lot of articles from in the public domain about capital accumulation and money leaving the country, that's too much of money. We have these capital flows going up. That's part of our problem, why we don't see so much. We're not having enough for the kind of development one. So we need to peg that. There's been a lot about the policing of hosts, and I think that's come up. We're not saying that we want a bloated public service. You need an efficient, streamlined public service. Critical hosts, you said there's an exception that will be made for that, yes. But we don't have a proper audit of this. How many vacancies, what sort of vacancies, what kind of skills they need, and so on. But we've been obviously trying to build our skills a bit over the last 20 years. We've tried to get more people into schools, more people into trust institutions, more people into further education and training institutions. We've got all these CCAs. We've got to ensure that these skills, we've got to ensure that they are skills and that we are able to have these skills available, right, in the market, to fill the position.
I can't speak for the public sector union, because I'm from a manufacturing union. We have certain things that we share, politically we share in common. But we also have different areas of work, and we work in a manufacturing environment. But you've got, and you do have, public sector unions. I'm not sure any of the public sector unions are here. But maybe Kasad would probably say a few things on the behalf of if they have that put in the mandate, probably say. I'm not sure. So I can't speak to that. There's been a lot that with the medium term budget policy statement estimates. Yes, there's got to be these cuts, and that these cuts are necessary to ensure that there's efficiency, curb wastage, build capacity, and so on. But you've got to look at it very carefully. We've got the highest uneven, the highest level of inequality in the world, in this country. We can't turn a blind eye to that. So we've got to ensure that we have to look at it. How do we deal with these levels of inequality? The rising levels of inequality. Yeah. I think the government has made that, and that's one of the key mandates is that we reduce these levels, and we must reduce them by a significant margin. There was some question about getting it mixed up there. There was a question about social prosperity. What do you mean by social prosperity? I think we must look at what is the sort of index. You can't just measure the quality of life simply by your GDP. The GDP is not the mystery, your products, goods, services. You can't just measure it by GDP. United Nations has actually shifted from GDP. They measure it, they have a thing like human happiness index. Let's ask people, are you happy about this? Are you happy about that? Are you happy about housing? Are you happy about the different services and your sanitation? We have to use different indicators. There are different indicators. So it's a broad term. Broad. I don't have one single definition for it. But I think if we look at it from a policy point, is that GDP, clearly the United Nations shifted from that, is that you cannot measure growth and people's prosperity just by looking at GDP figures. But you have very rich people. You have a majority of poor people. The thing about mobility, you raised issues about, there were issues raised about mobility, and that if the one side, one, if it says that the employment shrinks in one sector, yes, people do move. We accept that. But mobility isn't very easy sometimes it requires you to be actually multi-skilled. So you can't just have one core competency. You have to have a number of different skills to move around, to ensure that you can keep pace with that mobility. The money lenders thing that come up, so I should say that the rating agencies, at the end of the day, we've got to, look, they do limit your policy space. They're not the only agencies that limit your policy space. I mean, there are other global finance institutions. The WTO does that in a certain way, where it limits. The United Nations says we should have a development-oriented trade policy. But go to the WTO and see if that actually, just see if this is playing by free and fair rules. What kind of rules do they play by? There's no such thing as some neutrality here. These are very contested areas. The EBIA, just to explain that, to unpack it a bit, is that we've been, over the last, since the beginning of the year, let me say, because it was half last year, the end of last year, since the beginning of the year, we get different figures. It's very hard to get an audit of the figures. Treasury came to NEDLAC, and there are two chambers in NEDLAC. There's a public finance monetary policy chamber, and there's a labor market chamber. They came to brief the public finance monetary policy chamber, and they said, look, but it would also be appropriate to have the labor market chamber that deals with some of these issues present at this briefing. And as those briefing questions were asked, so don't take this as a
This is something from our own records and from our own colleague who happened to sit at the meeting. But they could not get clear answers from Treasury. Treasury said there were estimates. Treasury tried to couldn't explain fully the deadweight jobs. Deadweight jobs are jobs that have been created anyway. So they said they had a ratio of 2:1. And then, of course, if the figures were 211,000, then 2:1, two deadweight jobs every one job, then obviously that 211,000 would not be 211,000 beneficiaries in the ETIA. So it's a debatable thing, but there were no clear... the cell I got from the report we got from our colleagues sitting in the chamber was that it was full of ambivalence. No clear answers. They didn't even respond to the fact that when the national leaders made a lot about labor growth could actually take advantage of this and use these incentives, they didn't respond on that other than to say, well, look, it's not something that they like, but they can't stop it. IEEE, and the core business, what I want to do is I want to respond here, is that when the IEEE was launched, there was a lot of fanfare and a lot of excitement. You had the Green Accord, and I think just before that you had the Green Accord, which was signed during the COP17. And of course all these things were meant to fast track the introduction of renewable energy technologies into the country. And I think with any organization, you have your core, I understand this, but your core business. But the IIPP had two components. Price, 70%, 30% on social economic development. You can't now come as an IPP and say, we've got to find, government has got to draw a line here. They've got to tell us when this obligation is. We put up the tower, we put up the turbines and so on. You accepted that, the IPPs accepted that 70-30% ratio. Price, social economic development, so on. Localization of industry, sourcing of output. You accepted that. From a little bit of research that we've done, we looked at applications that many of the IPPs made in round one, round one window, when the bids were announced for the preferred bidders for wind power. And there were about 7 of them. And we looked at them and we tried to say, well, look, how do we know who the consortiums are? And the one way of finding out, we don't have all the answers, because you've got to do a bit of navigation here. If you write to them, and I write to one company, trying to get figures, it's very difficult. They didn't give me much. They hardly gave me anything. But when we looked at the round one, one of the places that we found we could source information was, all those winning bidders had to apply for a NERSA license. And in the application for a NERSA license, they had to state, how many jobs they created, what is the social economic development, they have to give us some kind of picture. A lot of them use very flowery language here. Now to come and say, look, social economic development is not our core. We put some money for the clinic, we put some money maybe for the school or whatever, or some we call it, we donate money for the community or towards the community trust or whatever. But now to say suddenly that it's a bit of hypocrisy. You accepted that. You accepted the rate of 70-30%. You made applications. In your applications, you stated, and it was not just NASA license applications. They also made applications to the DOE for the CDM, so that they get registered for the CDM credits. And the DOE is the designated national authority to issue all these CDMs. So you made applications there. And you must look at those applications. I have some of them on my system here. And you see those applications. The technology they're using, the consortiums, who are the partners, the jobs they're going to create, and over and above that, what is the broader social economic development? What are those investments that they're making there? What kind of investments are they making there? They accepted that. It doesn't have to come now to say this. What you should really be doing is saying, look, we started this round, we're into this project now, we are investing into this project, we are building it, we want to get electricity as quickly as possible onto the grid so we don't have problems like we had here on Sunday and things like that. So how do we actually start moving on that? The downside is that, and I think this is where government as well hasn't played a very strong role, is that the downside is that while you have this allocation for price, socioeconomic development, localization of industry, localization of technology, while you have that, none of them have any signed agreements in place.
If you compare how other countries develop their industries around renewable energy technology, yeah, it's a bit late. Maybe, we're coming on board now. Other countries have had a start. China used local content requirements. They use that very, very effectively. Right? Of course, now there's a downside to that because of some countries have been challenging it to the WTO and saying local content requirements is not fair. It's putting them at a disadvantage. They can't enter the market and so on. There's the Canadian case. But the fact of the matter is, they're not going to, we shouldn't really worry about that here because they're not going to be run to the WTO. Why? Because most of them have already got investments out here. Suzlon, India, Siemens, Germany, Nordex, Germany. I'm just talking about wind. I'm not even referring to the other technologies of it. So they're all here. If you go down to the ITC now, they're there. They've got exhibitions, there's business deals going on, and so on. So there's a lucrative. They understand, I think they accept that there's a lucrative market here. Right? But that lucrative market can only be lucrative for them, so long as we don't have a very competitive industry in renewables. So if we have it. So there's no signed agreements about technology transfer, and where have the local content, and I want to probably round up here, where have been the local content requirements? It's been absorbed, most of them have hit those thresholds that were there, or those targets or the thresholds. It's been in the construction and civil engineering areas, and the local service industry have benefited in some way. But construction, and they admit to this, are jobs of a short duration job. They could be semi-skilled, unskilled workers, and a short-duration jobs. Operation and maintenance requires very, very high skills, so they have to import those skills now. But the universities are trying to see what they can do. Stellenbosch University has set up something, some sort of institute or something. See, I'm not sure about the sector education and training authorities, what they're really doing. We need to look at that. We, the manufacturing sector, we need to look at that. But if we don't really have localization of industry, localization of technology, then we can't do that by saying, come, invest, and leave it at that. We've got to have tangible agreements in place. Brazil has used and leveraged, and they've got to have an industry. How did they do that? Because Brazil has Bendes, which is development debt, and what Bendes has done, they've made concessionary finance. Concessionary finance is that you want these contracts, but this is what we want from you. So finance through concessions, We're not even using that. IEC has entered into partnerships with some of the project developers and so on, and consortium. And they put money. But we need solid agreement on it. These must be transparent. They must be in the public domain. So that we know that, look, we are in a position. And the country has, studies show that the country has the infrastructure to develop a wide range of things. I mean, in the wind turbine industry. They're starting to build towers now. With one factory in Cougar, there's another one coming up in Atlantis, part of the agency's development and so on. But you have to have tangible agreements, and you have to set yourself. The logic must be that if importing 80% now, this year, then in the next 2 years it must come down to...
I suggest that perhaps you do put some of those issues in writing. I'm worried about that.
Okay.
I thought that sometimes the subject becomes...
So
I don't know if you have seen that some people in church, when the spirit comes, you can never stop, and I can say this is your subject. And I think under normal circumstances would like to be you the whole day. But we are a bit in trouble today because we thought we'd have up to our past four, but we don't. Members must be in the National Assembly by 3. And I don't like to send anybody back home without having been there. So we're still going to engage with you.
I've touched on, I think, some of the more important things that have come up in the two of the questions that have come from committee members and so on. And I look around. We're always willing to engage. This is part of my mandate is in the parliamentary office. We have to maintain some dialogue and communication with parliament and the political parties that are in parliament. Anyway, let me conclude by saying thank you, and thank you to the committee for giving us this opportunity. And I'll stop here.
Let me thank Minister through you, Harun. Yes.
Thank you. Maybe the other person saw the opportunity to do it in writing. just to pick it and then ask you that. Just last two questions. NUMSA has suggested creating high interest rate removal of inflation targeting as an instrument to stabilize prices. What one wants to check, does NUMSA have a proposal? I think my colleague has said that it just put your concerns, but without concretizing it, to say you think this is what needs to be done. Does NUMSA have a proposal on the alternative options to be used in ensuring the price stability other than inflation targeting? And then secondly, also you on the interest, high interest rates, you suggested that government needs just to spread that high interest rate. But the understanding is that the market forces determine the factors for the interest rate fluctuation. How do you think the government will, it will be possible for government just to deal with this high interest rate? It may be important for us, really. We all don't need this high interest rate, but maybe if you can suggest to say that this is the way you think it can be done when you do it in writing, then.
Okay, thank you very much. Can I just say to honorable members that you can also write to NUMSA follow-up questions, and then they will respond. So you must leave your email address. It's on your presentation. Okay. Let me take this opportunity to thank you once again, thank NUMSA. I think we are very happy as a committee that you are taking interest in the budget, because I think it's very important that we hear as many people as possible. Yes. We will get the committee to circulate here. I was saying that we are very happy that you're taking such interest on the budget, because I'm sure some of the issues you are raising will assist us as we shape and reshape the fiscal framework into the future. So you can be assured that we don't take any input lightly. There are challenges that the country is facing, and I think all of us must be alive to that. Your statement, for instance, says, when government has priorities for spending, it always wants to address or should be addressing issues of unemployment, poverty, inequality, which is true, as all of us will agree. But there is also the elephant in the room. And most cases, many of us don't deal with it, because all these issues become the functions of that, which is the economy that is not growing at the level that we want. Because otherwise, if that was the case, I'm sure we'll be having a different debate. In the NDP, we are saying if we are to achieve those objectives, the economy must grow at the level of 5% annually for that period. So if you don't reach that level, you'll be rest assured we're going to come back to this debate about fiscal consolidation and a whole lot of other things. But I think what is important for this FTDPS is to, I think what the minister is saying, to try to ensure that service delivery is not affected in the main. So even though there's some reduction overall in the budget, but when you go down to provincial, local, yes, that expenditure is kept, and it will grow again in the medium term, as you can see. But we do want it to grow even higher if the economy can go higher. So I think we have to come back to the issue of what do we do to grow the economy. We can even come back to a debate of the stimulus, because we know that our public debt is now sitting at 45% of GDP. Do you want to push it to 50? If you do, is it going to help the economy grow? So you start looking at the productive factors so that we don't increase the level of debt by borrowing money that does not help us grow the economy and create employment, because if I'm a grant, somebody must pay that debt. Maybe it won't be us sitting here. So there is always that caution. And remember, the minister is not saying we are not going to borrow. I think there's nowhere that he's saying that, but I think he's saying it's important that our level of deficit should not increase. Because if it does, then it pushes up public debt much faster. And before we know it, we could be sitting at 2 trillion. So we need to be careful. But we need to come back to that debate. It's a big debate. How do we grow the economy? Because if the economy grows higher, then we have more resources to spend. And sometimes we don't deal with that issue. All try to deal with, you know, the what we have and how we allocate it, but we must deal with how do we grow the cake. But I want to thank you very much, because I think you're raising very important issues, and we want to continue to engage with Musa, and we are taking into account the issues you have raised. Honourable members, can I suggest that you can have a 10-minute cut-off break, and then we are going to then take a presentation from Equal Education and Public Service Accountability Monitor. That's a joint submission from what I've been told, and try and deal with that. We have two more later, but because of the constraint, we will either have no lunch time or reduce that time. Basically, let's see how it goes. 10 minutes comfort break, we'll come back and then we'll take the next presentation so we can allow them to come and set up. Thank you very much. Make your presentations and we will allow members to engage with your presentation. Thank you very much.
I'd like to take the opportunity to thank the committee and the chairperson for allowing us to present our submission today. My name is Popolan Simaro. I'm the Parliamentary Officer for Equal Education, and I'm with my colleague, Zukiswa Kosa, who is with the Public Service Accountability Monitor and is a researcher there. So the focus of our presentation today is going to be on school infrastructure. School infrastructure budget, and we'll specifically focus on the education infrastructure grant and the accelerated school infrastructure delivery initiative, also known as a CD, scholar transport, and school nutrition through the National School Nutrition Program. And then we'll conclude. Just to start off with, to tell you what our organizations are about, Public Service Accountability Monitor is a civil society organization that aims to improve the provision of public services essential to the reduction of poverty by strengthening social accountability initiatives concerned with improving governance and public resource management in sub-Saharan Africa. Whereas Equal Education is a movement of learners, parents, teachers and community members working for quality and equality in the South African education system through research, analysis and activism. So the purpose of this presentation today is to comment on the Minister of Finance's 2014 medium-term budget policy statement in the first instance. Secondly, it is hoped that this submission will inform deliberations towards the 2015-16 budget. We seek to provide recommendations on proposed adjustments to education infrastructure conditional grants at both the national and provincial levels. We will provide an overview of expenditure trends and deliveries through the EIG and SBD. We will also examine the necessity of adequate scholar transport funding to meet the needs of learners in deep rural areas who have to travel long distances to access schooling. This submission will also take into account funding for school nutrition through the National School Nutrition Program. In this regard, the submission contains recommendations to Parliament to consider. The submission also further outlines priority areas identified by EE and PSAM researchers that require urgent attention in the provisioning of education in South Africa. In particular, the report outlines unanswered questions relating to planning, budgeting, and implementation. I'll hand over to my colleague.
Okay, thank you, Blanche. We'd also just like to emphasize that our recommendations and what we're going to present this morning, we're really looking forward to deliberations around it in order to improve our submission, because I think this is a very important stage that we feel we're at in terms of providing, we hope, useful interaction. Looking at the NTDPS, we expectedly note that education and health are prioritized, particularly over the medium term. In particular, in terms of education, post-school education is emphasized, which is certainly something that we welcome, but we feel that there are certain things we need to flag in relation to that. We note that in this particular instance in relation to higher education or post-school education, there's $832 billion for basic education and skills development. And 640, in fact, the latter should be education. $640 billion over the 2015 medium term for basic education. We're also encouraged, in terms of our submission right now, we're excited to have this opportunity because this is the first medium term strategic framework that is aligned with the NDP. So we really feel that in terms of our areas, which are education and there are programs within education, that, again, this is a critical time for us to begin to engage, to continue our engagement. We note also that 397.7 million rand is shifted from the indirect school infrastructure backlog grant to the education infrastructure grant. The various discussions we'll have, and hopefully we'll be able to paint our case quite clearly in terms of our concerns around infrastructure grants and the school nutrition grant and scholar transfer in particular. We also note, and this is taken from the minister's speech, but reflected in the statement overall as well, is that reductions in provincial and local conditional grants for target patterns under expenditure, the local government equitable share will be protected to ensure provision of food basic services. What we're really concerned about highlighting is that third part of that sentence, which relates to conditional grants and underspending or under expenditure. So, just to keep that in mind, we'd like to, focus on that. So in terms of, again, we'll focus on what we'll prioritize or highlight, we'll focus on education. We feel that there's a worrying lack of detail in relation to basic education, although we do admit that there is an emphasis on the importance of education, as we would expect. We feel that there's no clear articulation, and this continues on from previous, previous findings in the overall budget, the initial 2014-15 budget, and we find again now that there isn't a sufficient articulation of allocations for gazetted norms and standards in terms of school infrastructure. Hope Olang is going to elaborate on this as well. We also feel, that there's a focus on under-expenditure, as I said, on conditional grants. And while this is certainly important, given, as we discussed at length as well, the kind of economic climate of our country, or, globally as well, this is important. But we also think that this poses certain risks that we'd like to highlight over the course of our presentation or our submission. The Minister also highlights that there's significant resources that are left unallocated, and this is, this is something in going through the actual budget statement, there's significant resources that are left unallocated. And this, of course, the explanation is that there's a need to buffer against fiscal shocks or potential fiscal shocks in the future or in the medium term. But again, we feel that this poses certain threats in some areas relating to our areas of interest. And I think we do elaborate on this within the written submission. We welcome certainly the reduction of travel and subsistence on a globular kind of level within the statement. We look at the $555 million that this relates to, and it's in the bigger scheme of things, particularly gargantuan sum, but we still welcome it. At the same time, we would like to flag the notions around reductions in program oversight with a particular focus on the school nutrition program. So certainly it's important, reductions in travel assistance are important. But when we talk of the nutrition program, and we know that, and this again is within our written submission, there are intentions to decrease the budget, specifically on travel oversight trips. So we think that this is something that requires greater circumspection. In relation to considerations over the medium-term expenditure framework, there are implications for service delivery education and questions that you would like to pose, and certainly we hope perhaps in the deliberations we have now we might have some answers, hopefully, but we hope that our questions in themselves will provide some useful discussion. In relation to the school nutrition grant, we'd like to ask, you know, to inquire about what trade-offs have been made in terms of long-term infrastructure delivery, in terms of backlogs and maintenance. And again, this is elaborated on in our written submission, but Hopalang will speak on this as well. We also would like to ask what has informed the reprioritization of the school infrastructure backlog and education infrastructure grants in the state. And again, the explanations given, we feel, are perhaps inadequate. And within the NTVP, we find that there isn't, again, further elaboration. I won't go into detail on this, but I think many, you know, organizations and within Department of Basic Education themselves and within.
Sorry. Yes. Thank you, Honourable Chair. We are a little bit confused here because I think the presentation and the documents we have are not identical.
Let's check. There is the presentation, the detailed one that was spread.
It's been following me. We don't have it.
There's a submission that was sent. So she's actually make reference to it. But do members say not a PowerPoint. The actual submission. You have it. Okay.
I don't have it.
Okay. Can we make copies quickly for members? We'll quickly make copies for members. Apparently it was emailed to all of us, but perhaps others did not receive it. Okay, so as she keeps referring to the submission, she's referring to that.
Okay.
So if people can use the PowerPoint.
Thank you, Chair. So, yeah, I think it's important at this point, though, to acknowledge the fact that there has been significant progress made in delivery of school infrastructure in our country, and this we would like to highlight, and I think it's something that we need to acknowledge. At the same time, however, many South African schools are considered unsafe and many learners are still being educated within inappropriate infrastructure conditions. And if we look back to 2004, we know that, you know, promises were made in terms of the delivery in relation to school infrastructure. So I think this is not to highlight the negative necessarily, but certainly just as a reminder, a very important reminder of where we were.
Just a minute. I'm told that your PowerPoint presentation is amended as well. And members might be hearing.
There'll only be one slide that I'll speak to that. Yeah. So in terms of the comprehensive report, it hasn't changed substantially, bar one slide.
Okay.
And the numbering is still the same on the slide. So page 7 on your PowerPoint to page 7 that we're looking at now.
Thank you,
Jay. Okay, so should we move on to the next? Thank you. So, what we'll speak to are several budget allocations in relation to infrastructure, and because we are focusing on education in particular, some of our, you know, presentation might seem a bit, you know, overly detailed, but it's important in order that we can justify what it is we're saying. So, the education infrastructure grant is intended to be supplementary to provincial infrastructure programs, and I'll speak just shortly now about the provincial infrastructure programs themselves. And its purpose is to enhance the speed with which infrastructure delivery happens. TD has a similar objective, and Hopalang will kind of continue on this. So, this is particularly important in provinces like the Eastern Cape, where we come from, or where I come from. Particularly in areas of underperformance, but also where high backlogs or high numbers of backlogs in terms of school infrastructure exist. Within the 2014 division of Revenue Bill, we know that there were no media adjustments that were allocated to provinces, and to a certain extent may say, speak to good performance in terms of budget allocations, but there are a number of things we need to consider, which we'll shortly. We saw that there is insufficient transparency in terms of the equal education infrastructure grant, given its importance and given its, its implementation in rural lands. And so the reason that it becomes important for us to have this discussion now is primarily looking at, the 2015 budget and the allocations and, the need to kind of have those budgets speak to current plans and current performance. We find that the infrastructure project plans are available at provincial education and through provincial votes, but again, there are a considerable gaps in terms of this information in relation to the need to assess performance and progress in terms of delivery and performance. So we also note that, and we note with a degree of alarm, the intent to decrease allocations. And again, we must place a disclaimer here, because given inadequate or insufficient levels of transparency in terms of the education infrastructure grant, it does place a degree of worry around knowledge of whether or not targets have been met, and it becomes difficult to assess this. Okay, so I won't speak to the slide to any great length, but perhaps, during question time we can further engage on this. But it's important to note here that the proposed $9.4 billion in 2015-16 is significantly less than was prioritized or projected in the 2013 NCPPs, and we'd like to kind of raise questions around that. Again, kind of, given the context under which performance has occurred, or underperformance, or the delay in terms of infrastructure provisioning in education. We'd also like to question the degree to which the funds allocated will be sufficient for the implementation of the norms and standards which were promulgated in 2013 by the Minister of Basic Education. We'd also like to explicitly look at whether or not, where these resources will come from in terms of the norms and standards that have been presentable. And before I hand over to Hopalang to speak about SE, this is a look, and I hope I'll speak to it quite clearly. This is the one slide that doesn't appear when members, what you have before you, and I apologize for that, but I'll speak to it simply. It does, however, appear within the written submission, if I remember correctly, and if I don't, we'll have to be saying that too. So what you have on projected above there are provincial allocation, infrastructure allocations. Each of the two blocks refers to a province, so the first is the Eastern Cape, going all the way along, and the final block relates to the growth in infrastructure on a national scale, so the kind of composite look at the budget. So if you look at the first, for example, with relation to the Eastern Cape, we see that there's an average growth over the NTF that is negative. So these are real figures in both cases. The second look relates to real change between 2013-14, so not looking forward, but looking between 2013-14 and 2014-15. And we note the concern there as well that in terms of the provincial infrastructure allocations, in real terms, those are decreasing quite drastically. And when we look at the composite figure at the end, we see a nominal increase in the budget between the two years, 2013-14 and 2014-15, of 3.78%, looking at all the provincial allocations. In terms of the medium-term growth, this is also negative. And I think this is something that, is worrisome for us when we look at the real figures and real growth, and in this case, decrease. So in terms of infrastructure and the priority that I think we placed as a country on it, which is articulated in all government documents that relate to education infrastructure. I think this is something that we definitely need to place emphasis on and ask questions around going forward in the 2015-16 budget. What can we expect, and how will the current reductions or potential reductions impact on infrastructure delivery to schools?
So I'll continue with school infrastructure, referring specifically to ACD. So the school infrastructure backlog grant, which is commonly known as a CD, was intended to ensure the eradication of inappropriate schools by replacing 496 mud schools between the 2011-12 and 2013-14 financial years, and to provide basic services such as water, sanitation, and electricity within the same financial year. 8.2 billion rand was allocated to this budget. However, due to massive challenges with regards to expenditure over the years, the length of the project has been extended and the budget reduced. It was stated by National Treasury in February 2014 that to give effect to cabinet-approved budget reduction, 1.2 billion over the medium term has been reduced from spending on the school infrastructure backlog grant. The reductions to the school infrastructure grant align this allocation more closely with the ability of the sector to deliver school infrastructure and to extend the deadline for addressing the school infrastructure backlog by 1 year, from 2015-16 to 2016-17. So instead of a CD being completed in the 2013-14 financial year dated above, or as the initial outcome, it has now been extended to 2016-17. These reductions occurred due to the DBE's under expenditure of its budget. 89% was underspent in 2011-12 and 68% in 2012-13. The reductions are illustrated in this table. I hope you can see it clearly. If you focus on 2013-14, you'll notice that the budget was reduced from approximately 5 billion first allocated in 2011-12 to a revised actual allocation of 1.9 billion. The 2014-15 budget was also reduced. Approximately 2.9 billion was allocated to a CD in the main 2014-15 budget, and almost 400 million of this has not been shifted to the Western Cape Education Infrastructure Grant. As a result, the province's main EIG allocation increased from 485 million to 888 million. I'll now look at scholar transport. So to begin with, just highlight that there are numerous challenges facing the South African education system in the provision of scholar transport. Firstly, the delivery of this service requires the Departments of Transport and Basic Education to work together to ensure the adequate data capturing of the number of learners in need, sufficient budgeting to meet this need, and that the service actually reaches the intended beneficiaries. But these cross-cutting roles have resulted in confusion and inertia on the ground. It is unclear whose responsibility it is to provide this service. For example, in the Eastern Cape, service delivery targets are set by the Education Department, but the budget of scholar transport comes from the Eastern Cape Department of Transport. This makes it difficult to hold a particular department accountable for poor or no implementation. There are thousands of learners in rural provinces who walk long distances to access schooling daily. Recent media reports have highlighted that in some provinces, service providers are still owed money by provincial departments for providing transport to learners. And that funding is made, and another problem, that funding that is made available by provinces is not enough to transport all qualifying learners to school. It is notable, therefore, that despite urgent needs, the 2014 medium-term budget policy statement and Division of Revenue Amendment Bill did not allocate funding for learner transport exclusively. We recommend that this matter be taken into consideration. This table shows the number of learners provided with transport. On one row, that's the top row, if I'm correct. The top row, which is derived from the Eastern Cape Department of Education, and I guess the amount allocated for implementation of scholar transport, which is derived from the Eastern Cape Department of Transport. It shows that spending on transport decreasing in the 2014-15 financial year, despite an increase in learner numbers requiring transport. The estimated budget for 2015-16 is also less than that of the 2013 financial year, even though there is an estimated increase in the number of learners requiring transport in the 2015-16 financial year. So more learners but less money to provide the service. and then on to school nutrition.
So we have similar trends reflected to some degree between scholar transport and the school nutrition program. And the school nutrition program is, you know, just to give a little bit of background, but I don't want to assume that, you know, members are all on the same page in terms of the conditional grant. But it is a conditional grant and is rolled out at provincial level and has different modes of delivery. So some are decentralized, others are centralized, depending on the province. And this has its own challenges in terms of financial management, but also in terms of oversight functions within the conditional grant or within this program. Just a few things to highlight within the grant and the projections in terms of the medium term, as well as in the current financial year, looking back between 2013-14 and 2015-16, 14-15 rather. I may have made an error, and this may be the second page that wasn't or initially reflected in the submission, but does speak to figures that are already presented in the document itself. So the easy take when you look at real change between the two financial years, it's important to note that there's a decrease in the allocation, in the expected allocation for the school nutrition program. In some respects, we may talk about the number of learners that migrate out of a province like the Eastern Cape into other provinces, but this isn't reflected in terms of growth within those other provinces where these learners are expected to or understood to be migrating to. We'd also like to flag that, you know, currently we know that within Gauteng and reports in KwaZulu-Natal as well, learners who've been cut off from the school nutrition program because of budgetary restrictions in quintiles 4 and 5 have been found to be suffering and have been found to be experiencing hunger. And so there are questions around regressions within the conditional grant that services the most vulnerable within our communities. We'd also like to consider or recommend that the Department of Basic Education through National Treasury reconsider the current quintile system in relation specifically to provisioning of nutrition on this program for learners. We're frightened by reports of restrictions and reductions within this budget. We're frightened by reports of learners being cut off at different in different provinces. And this has significant implications for learners, particularly when the school nutrition program is such a vital program. The Human Rights Commission has highlighted that nutrition is potentially, you know, the most significant challenge facing learners in South Africa today. And I think these are questions that we certainly need to be faced with or placed squarely to be answered in the medium term, especially in the upcoming budget. Next slide. In terms of the medium term budget statement, we certainly understand that, you know, Minister couldn't possibly talk about every single thing that requires attention. But what we focus on in education and in basic education are some of the key things that have a direct impact on learners and have a direct impact on attainment of learners or of education within the education system. We also note, again, we acknowledge that the minister cannot speak within the medium term to, you know, such specific levels of programming, but certain conditional grants that are this vital and that are this substantial within the general social spending or social allocation, I think do require some direct attention. If we look, again, at what presented or projected above, nationally we see that in terms of the nominal change between 2013 and 2014 for the nutrition program, there's an increase, or was an increase of 5.58%. And I think on average that's something to speak positively about. But again, these are nominal figures. When we look at a real change, however, between 2013-14, we see a decrease in the budget of 0.54%. And this is substantial, significant, given the fact that in some cases we see an increase in particular provinces of learners needing or needing to benefit from this nutrition program. We're also aware that National Treasury has stipulated, or certainly the Department of Basic Education has been quite articulate and explicit about making sure that only learners within quintile 1 through 3 benefit from this program, and where provinces have been feeding learners in quintile 4 and 5, that this will not be supported by Treasury allocation. So this is understandable given the mandate or the policy of this nutrition program, but when we consider the needs of the learners, this is something that we need to, we feel, certainly worry about. In terms of targeting vulnerable learners. We also know that there are several reports amongst those, a human and HSRT report indicating that even though we understand learners in quintile 4 and 5 to be from more affluent backgrounds or who may not need support from a conditional grant like the nutrition program, we also know that there are several learners who come from backgrounds that would otherwise deserve to be or are eligible to be supported on this nutrition program. So again, this speaks to the quintile system as a whole, but certainly speaks to a need to look at the conditional grant and the potential restrictions in areas of underspending. We do know that there are provinces where underspending within the nutrition program has happened. And again, this may or may not pose problems in terms of this particular grant. Okay, quite quickly. Okay. So we've been quite brief in terms of our submission, and we hope that this will give us an opportunity to engage with members and certainly to get critical feedback. And we know that some of what we have here may not be as accurate as we'd like it to be, but certainly we believe that what we have here is evidence-based. But again, we look forward to interaction. So in terms of our recommendations, we're very excited by the emphasis, Minister Nene's emphasis in the MTDP on the focus on building capacity of the public sector. We do speak to greater detail within our submission about issues of financial management and so on. But amongst these, the Minister did mention that this is certainly a priority, and we look forward to seeing how this will be implemented. In terms of specific recommendations to the DBE, we certainly would like to see allocation and spending of budgets for infrastructure maintenance. And we haven't spoken to this in our oral submission now, but it certainly is an issue of great concern, particularly given the importance of maintenance and the backlogs in maintenance of infrastructure, school infrastructure. We also would like the Department of Basic Education to provide explanations for reductions in key budgets in relation to education infrastructure and the potential implications of these. We feel that it isn't an adequate degree of explicit explanation about what's going to happen, why what has happened in the current budget. We would like to recommend that the Department of Basic Education and National Treasury must improve planning alignment between the provincial education departments and the department itself, the national department, with a specific focus on maintaining accurate management data that is to allow rigorous monitoring and evaluation, which also should allow close public scrutiny. So as a civil society, you know, group or civil society organizations, we certainly would like to have spaces of greater engagement and the importance of, you know, the public, schools, teachers, learners, with a specific focus on the Northern Standards, which are, you know, currently underway in terms of being rolled out. I think this is one thing that we really would like to emphasize. Currently, we feel that there isn't sufficient space for proper monitoring and evaluation from a community or public perspective. But certainly we know that spaces have been opened more so than previous years. We, particularly now speaking in the very short term, in terms of the 29th of November, with the publication of the Northern Standards or the plan, provincially and otherwise, we would certainly like to recommend that it be publicly available in order that, you know, an ordinary learner in a school governing body, a principal, can understand what is going to happen within their areas, particularly schools that are going to benefit or should benefit from the norms and the regulations. Again, in terms of recommendations, we would certainly like to emphasize the adoption of the National Scholar Transport Policy of 2009. As Hopalang has kind of spoken to, there are several issues here that are urgent and really do require immediate attention, particularly when you consider the distances that learners have to travel and growing need in some cases that isn't being met by growing budgets. And this is certainly one thing that is close to our hearts. In terms of, again, scholar transport, this speaks to databases and maintaining of accurate information and rigorous information. We'd like to see an improvement in this. In order that when we speak about the growing needs of learners, this effect is met at the department level as well with accurate information in order to plan and predict the needs of provinces. So we think about the Eastern Cape in particular because of the need, both in terms of, you know, the number of learners, but the distances of learners in provinces like the Eastern Cape have to travel. So it's not just the Eastern Cape. We would also like to emphasize and see the creation of a grant that's geared at providing learners, as I say, with transport. And, yeah, perhaps just speak of all the provinces where there is a need. Of course, the need does tend to be acute in certain provinces. We would also like to caution the DBE, and perhaps there are ways in which we could engage large members about more explicit ways of talking about it. Against reduction, but a major budget pertaining to monitoring and oversight. We certainly understand this, and there's emphasis on reductions in travel and expenditure or travel and subsistence. But when this speaks to at the DBE's level, when it speaks to the number of or the size of monitoring and evaluation teams that go out and survey the nutrition program, that go out and monitor schools, we really do fear that this may take us back. So we admit and acknowledge that there has been progress, even within the nutrition program in terms of implementation. But we'd certainly like to caution against reductions within this particular travel issue or travel area. And we know that this has been flagged by DBE. We would also like to recommend the consideration that all learners or all eligible learners be included in the school nutrition program. This, of course, you know, will have significant budgetary implications, but we really do feel that in cases where learners in quintiles 4 and 5 are said to be ineligible to benefit from the Department of Education's conditional grant on nutrition, we would like to ask then what happens to those learners who are in need and those learners who are in vulnerable positions but happen to fall into the more affluent categories or happen to fall to attend schools in quintiles 4 and 5. And in fact, you know, there has been discussions on where around the very quintile system. This is something that we would like to recommend be reviewed because there are thousands of learners and we've seen reports based us in the case of N and Gauteng and other provinces where learners are in fact going hungry who've been cut off or who aren't considered eligible to benefit from the school nutrition program. So this is another area. Okay, just to conclude, and perhaps we hope that what we've spoken to now does speak to what we'd like to see in the 2015 budget for consideration by National Treasury and by the Department of Basic Education. But in terms of the 2015 budget, we feel that emphasis on post-school education is important, but we still would like to see stronger traces of basic education and the elements we've spoken to reflected in the 2015 budget. We haven't spoken to early childhood development, but this is certainly an area that we feel is marginalized to a great degree within our budget overall, and perhaps this is a story for another time if we will be welcomed back. We would like to see the conditional grant targeting the most vulnerable learners, and this must be better or more clearly articulated and prioritized. The most vulnerable learners don't always occur within the most vulnerable quintiles, as I've said, and this is something that requires attention. We feel that the silence in these areas, in the medium term, you know, policy statement is disconcerting given the needs that we've underlined. Again, the quintile system and targeting is important. And the protection or the need for the protection of traditional grants in terms of infrastructure and nutrition we feel is how significant and important. We would like to recommend that there be a much clearer allocation of resources that aligns with care plans, speaking now specifically to school infrastructure and the significant gaps in terms of the available knowledge and the available performance-related knowledge year on year. And this isn't a new problem that we were highlighting, but certainly we'd like to see much clearer allocation of resources to care performance targets. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you very much for the presentation. Like we did with the first presentation, their responses can be writing, so you don't have to respond to everything directly now. So we'll also need your email so that members can send follow-up questions. But for now, we will allow members to ask questions, comments. Just take all the open at the end, you can, both of you can share the responses. Okay, Honorable Member. Honorable Sheikh Imam, you'll get that.
Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Honorable Sheikh, we will follow.
Thank you, first of all, for that presentation. But I want to comment you on that one the issue of the quintile 4 and 5, especially. In my observation as well, I found those challenges in schools that were not in the rural areas, that were in the urban areas, and there were learners that were very seriously affected coming to school hungry. And because they're not in the equivalent of 4 and 5, they're not entitled to that education, and that's a very, very serious challenge. But at the same time, you know, resources are limited. We have to, you know, divert them into all different areas. Is there any role you could play in trying to facilitate civil society and private businesses in also being involved in trying to assist these schools and things where government's not able to do enough as a result of the limited resources? The second one, I just wanted to know, in terms of those schools in the Eastern Cape, do you perhaps have any idea of how many of them have now been built in terms of that 400 and some of that were supposed to be built? And I know it's been moved to 2015, 2016. Do you perhaps have an idea of how many of them have already been completed? And the one last thing I want to know is, in terms of school transport, has the building of new schools in that area not reduced the need for school transport as a result of you know, more schools being built generally? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Sick.
Thanks, Honourable Chairperson. The quality of the presentation, and I'm hoping that it's not because it's women that it is of such high quality. I hope men can also provide such deep presentations. But yes, so my input is not questions to be presented, but more that the information that is given to us, that we take it and we make sure that as this committee that it is fixed. So I just want to comment on a few of the issues that I believe that need some attention, which has been highlighted by the presenters. The page 7, that one, I'm hoping that this photo is a very old photo, because, you know, in 2014, the statement that was made by the former president that there's no pupil learning under the tree in mud school any dangerous conditions, you know, and I'm not, as much as I'm going to mention the Eastern Cape, I believe that, especially in the Eastern Cape, there are still mud schools that children are learning under. There are still trees that children are learning under. So it is an indictment on our government that is still the situation. And how do we expect to produce leaders if that is what they are, those are the conditions that they learn under? My comment is similar, the same comment to the picture on page 9, or sorry, slide 9, which again, you know, you have scared children crammed up under something called a structure there, which obviously is not safe and not conducive to learning. So it is a concern. The next one is slide number 13. Again, we've had a report of the subsidy, but amount that has been allocated and much been spent, and reasons given previously were obviously the service providers and the contractors that did not perform, etc. So again, I mean, you're looking at not even 20% of the, or just about 20% of the budget that has been used or the allocation. Slide number 14, the young lady there mentioned about the long distance that rural learners in rural provinces walk. I think that is an understatement, because I've driven through the rural areas and it's actually not long, it's very long. And, you know, sometimes you see them at about 10 o'clock or walking to school. And you can imagine how much schooling they've missed out on. Slide number 20. Sorry, it was covered. But, the comment I wanted to make there before the presenter gave the answer was that he specifically is in case, but I wrote it all and she did cover it. She said yes, it's also covered there. And then on slide number 21, the school's nutrition program, which is a big problem. Now, again, I've had experience with this. The reasons that have been given are that the service providers are not paid by the provinces. Now, what you find, a lot of these service providers are small businesses. And, you know, the bigger businesses can thrive, on, although they shouldn't, on 2-3 months of cash flow or lack of cash flow. Whereas a small business, 1 month is problematic. So I think that's where we need to ensure that we follow up to see that those service providers are paid by the provinces, because they receive the money from national government, or national treasury, and they don't give it to the service providers. That's the reasons that have been given. I also noticed that textbooks have not been included in this allocation. Not there isn't any emphasis or focus that has been given on textbook, and because that is obviously one of the issues that need serious attention, as we know, for the past number of years. And then with regards to transport in general, something really needs to be done. Because when we talk about schools transport, then I believe a school, you know, a learner should be transported in a vehicle that is suitable for a child, not suitable for animals. Because you find a lot of times these youngsters are learners are transported in buggies that can just start get onto off the road or onto the road. So I think transport on its own is not adequate. We need to make sure that it is proper transport that is suitable for transport of human beings. And that's all that I have on the chairperson.
Should I allow them to respond and then we can come back if they follow up? Okay, you may respond.
I think he will answer the questions relating to the school nutrition program. Okay. With regards to SPD and the number of schools, I was actually trying to remember now. It's in the 70s. I think we're at 74 right now. And others are still under construction, according to the Department of Basic Education. The first 49, so the initial plan was to put them in batches. The first 49, and then if I remember correctly, 150, and then something, 300 and something. But the 49 took a very long time to build, and if I'm correct, they were completed at the end of March this year, 2014. They were supposed to be completed in the 2011 all financial year. So, yes, there have been many, many delays in that regard. In terms of school transport sort of being mitigated by the SED and the new school, there aren't a lot of new schools, unfortunately. And we actually went on a recent trip to the Eastern Cape, visited quite a number of schools. We were in Mount Fletcher, Pickport, St. John's, if I remember, Illiboden. And all those schools and all the principals we met with told us that learners are traveling for kilometers, like 17 kilometers, over mountains, through ravines, and they really struggled to get to school because the schools are not located anywhere near the main road, so they couldn't even catch, a bike or anything like that. So we didn't hear anything with regard of, oh, okay, the presence of these new schools have sort of made things better. And I also think with ICD there are issues around the learner numbers. That in some of those schools, the schools are too big, the learner numbers are too few. So those are the things that still need to be worked out. You referred to a picture. I want to see if I can go back. This picture, as far as I'm very clear. We took this in September at a school called Sampson. We spoke to a teacher there, and it's in the Eastern Cape. My colleague, Yurisa, is the back there. Do you remember where it was? Was it Point St. John's? Oh, yeah. But it's called Sampson. Yeah, it's called Sampson Junior Primary School, if I'm correct. It's in the Eastern Cape. We looked for the name, so we were given a CD list, and it's just publicly available. You can get it on the department website. And this school, as you can see, it's an innovative structure. And the mandate of a CD has sort of changed from the provision, from the eradication of must schools to the eradication of inappropriate schools. Inappropriate including zinc, asbestos, all these things. So this would be an inappropriate school. But Sampson does not fall under the CD list. And the teacher wasn't sure when, how the school was going to be fixed. But it's been in this condition for a very, very long time. In terms of a comment around the school nutrition program, before Zuki comes in, the payment of service providers. We also asked about that during this trip to the Eastern Cape. It happened in September, quite recently. The school does say that the department is quite good at depositing money into their bank accounts, like always timely, so they're not really confronted with a lot of problems in terms of money coming in. But that's like directly to the school. We are not sure about to the service provider specifically. But yeah, and a few challenges were also mentioned.
Thank you also for the encouraging comment on the content. And we hope that what's contained here will hopefully be detected, and if we are able to, we'll strengthen our submission as well for the upcoming budget. But in terms of the question around limited resources in relation to quintile 4 and 5 question, I think that's definitely a consideration, and it's the reality that there is only so much in a public purse. But amongst the things that we, the work we do at the DFAM and also, at Equal Education is to emphasize on far better spending and management of resources that we, of available resources. And as I said, there has been improvement in this particular conditional grant. So perhaps the question also in relation to, yes, resources are limited. The question I think that you raised is interesting. What is the role of civil society and private business in this context? The Department of Education has been quite good about supporting interventions by NGOs, for example, that support the school nutrition program. So several provinces, including the Eastern Cape, and I can speak with, authority in terms of the Eastern Cape because that's where I live and work, there are organizations that support the production, food production initiatives to support the school nutrition program. But because there are also significant gaps in intersectoral, interdepartmental coordination, so for example, where the Department of Agriculture could support in terms of actual, agricultural interventions at schools because there's a food production component in the SNP, civil society and or NGOs have kind of filled that gap to a certain extent, but there's only so much they themselves can do given their own limited resources. But I think there have been some really good areas of success, even within the Eastern Cape in this issue, where NGOs can support food production initiatives within a school. The BBE supports this curriculum kind of encouragement within a school. Social development and health also have their role to play. So there are instances where this has worked, but perhaps there needs to be a concerted effort in that intersectoral or interdepartmental collaboration. And also, perhaps greater encouragement of engagement of community members themselves. So there are women, cooperatives or female, women-led cooperatives in communities that can really push the food production aspect, but also push knowledge generation within school context. So I think, we don't want to sit here and say that nothing works, but there is a lot that's working. But that interplay between private business, civil society, NGOs, various, provincial departments, and community members is one that perhaps requires much closer intervention. We speak also of the poverty alleviation strategies and the most recent food and nutrition strategy that was released by the Department of Social Development, I think under correction. Nutrition and I do speak under correction. Certainly it's a fairly new policy that we're quite encouraged and excited by, and perhaps that's where some of the important interactions lie in terms of this particular conditional grant. Because you're right, there is significant space for research like ours to play a role, and NGOs that are on the ground delivering knowledge and expertise can also play a role. Gosh, I'm a top now. Service provider question on the SNP has been covered. The issues around, certainly the picture, the photos and these, we could actually have gone out and picked the most deplorable examples in the Eastern Cape. This one, encouragingly enough, was taken in 2005 when we did, this was now, a long time ago, thank goodness. But when we go around the province still, and again, I speak of the Eastern Cape, there are many replicas of this context where, whether one, there's one structure within the school that's a mud structure or several structures or a vestal. So while this photo is certainly dated and it was put there just to emphasize where we started in terms of our analysis and our monitoring over the years of infrastructure provisioning, we could find, smart to like this, sadly, very sadly. Thank you.
Sorry, I just have one more thing to say around nutrition and the role of civil society. It really answered the question, but in terms of schools themselves and growing their own food and food gardens and all of that, to sort of cut down costs and to concentrate supply of food, we found that those a few principals wanted something like that, but struggles because of water problems in the Eastern Cape. So we seem to have gone a little dry during the dry season. And a lot of schools have water tanks, but none of the water tanks had any water in it because there hadn't been rain. And it's quite expensive for schools. The schools have to buy water. And the further away they are, and a lot of the ones that look like they are far, have to pay quite a lot of money because the roads are not exactly in the best conditions. The schools that are closer to like the urban areas like Mthatha pay less. These are the ones like we went to, these are our three schools, pay less money because it's easier to get to them, which I found quite peculiar. But yeah.
Before I take more questions, just to say that I think the main the committee shares your concern. In fact, if I'm correct, in September there was a meeting with the Department of Basic Education because we were concerned ourselves, particularly about the grant for infrastructure. But I recall that one of the reasons why Treasury had effected those reductions was lack of expenditure. And then there was the indirect grant that was then effected. I know the Minister of Basic Education has been a lot in the Eastern Cape. So you can be assured that it's something that is on our radar screen as we speak, because we are concerned ourselves about this problem. I don't think 20 years down the line we should have children learning under trees and in under structures that are safe. So the committee will be paying attention to that. But as I say, the problem is not always the money. I think in the long run, you see that the resources will come back on stream and capacity is sorted out. But I think, obviously, Treasury wouldn't keep allocating huge sums of money in a program that was not spending. And we have discussed this with Treasury. And it's something that we are looking at. In fact, we were planning to visit the Eastern Cape as a committee. Unfortunately, we may not be able to do this year, but we will definitely win because that's when there were a lot of problems. But I know that there's been a lot of interventions now, probably with major improvements, but we want to see more happening. Perhaps one of the things we should say is that because you have done a lot of work looking at school infrastructure, you should share that information with us. So that, because I know the problem might not just be the Eastern Cape. So we need to have a holistic picture so that we are able to improve. So even though there may not be immediate changes on the appropriation bill now for the MTPTS, but certainly I think going into the future, we'd like to relook at that and make sure that, you know, education is adequately resourced, but there has to be productivity. Whether it's building of schools and how we disperse grants for scholar transport and various things, that they are done in the most efficient and effective manner. And making sure that no children are disadvantaged at all. So in terms of the goal, I think we are driving in the same direction. We just need to, I'm sure members would like to study your report more and engage with you again so that we can look at how we can assist to make sure that we do away with this problem. I'm sure all of us sitting here don't want to be schools like that, that you just showed, not in this current period. And I think we're going to, if we have to engage with education again, we're going to do it, so that they can show us their plans on how they are going to deal with this problem. And if, obviously, when resources become the problem, we'll then engage with National Treasury. But I think it's important that we get the efficiencies and effectiveness, right, particularly of the grants. A lot of conditional grants have been very ineffective and as a result created backlog. Honourable members, you may still comment, but I think but the issues they are raising are fairly the issues that are on our table, and we should be able to, I think, engage more with them, because I think it's our concern. But I will take a few comments quickly, and then allow them to respond. Honorable Madhopa.
Thank you. No, then, I think the exams are clearly, their presentation is what we are all looking for in the community. But on the issue of education is a very important priority of our government. And the access to education is key for our community. But I want to check what are the other components of this, or other components of the components that the components of access to education that can hinder the education rather than the infrastructure, because seemingly it's like only focusing only in infrastructure development, not on the other components that may hinder the access to education. And also the issue of transparency is a key and a value for one of the values of our government, the issue of transparency. You have raised your concern around the issue of the lack of transparency on the EIT, and what you want to check is whether this particular challenge you are experiencing in the whole country, or there is a specific province where you are experiencing this, because in other presentations you are indicating that in that province this is the challenge, whether this one is all over in the country. Maybe let me pause now and check, because the chair has summed up that we must look at the document, and what you have raised is most of the things that you have raised. But also, if you can come up with a proposal or suggestions rather than, I understand the issue of allocation money and integration on the corner transport, because you have raised that one is a concern. I had a stakeholders meeting in my constituency, it was a concern, the issue of the scholar transport. Maybe what are the proposals that you are putting forward to the committee to consider to address that particular challenge?
Honorable Shopper.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just want to express my deepest gratitude and excitement in seeing that the youth is standing up for itself. This is a very clear example of what the youth should be doing. And I would like them to leave their contacts, and we will be discussing a lot with them after we have read and actually gone through every item. But keep up the good work. Thanks.
I wanted to ask National Treasurer if you want to make any comment on that infrastructure grant. You have noted the point. Okay. Don't be afraid. we won't put you into trouble. But I don't want sometimes for you students to say, oh, if only it gave us a chance to clarify. But I think that I've made the point that we need more capacity in the department to do this work, so that resources should not just be allocated and they sit there. And National Treasurer has also noted that. But I think generally we are happy with your presentation. Job well done. You must keep in touch. But I'll allow you to have last comments, and members do want your contact details, because we are going to focus on this issue. With the committees agreed, education is very key. Issue of education skills, we will be listening to the universities after this, because we believe that co-schooling is one of the things we're also going to focus on. But let me allow you for your concluding remarks.
Thank you,
Chair.
Thank you,
Honorable
Members.
Thank you.
Again, Chair, and to the committee as well. The one question that we haven't answered before, but I think it actually can be incorporated in my response now, is about the textbooks and whether or not, or what kind of attention needs to be placed there. So certainly, you know, I think we can echo, you know, from quite a while back, Minister Motheha's, in fact, it was a presidential statement around, you know, the importance of textbooks, teachers, and punctuality. about time spent in the classroom and so on. So certainly textbooks is one vital component, and the availability of textbooks to all learners at the right time within the academic year. So I won't go into detail on this because I think we're all familiar with the problems around that, and several kind of organizations, Equal Education included, I believe, have kind of intervened at this, you know, in various ways. I'm quite personally, on a quite personal level, very closely attached to issues of early child development. So, our organization isn't focused on ECD per se, but we're focused on basic education and other aspects. So, maybe I'll get back to work in the told why were you talking about ECD, but I think ECD is a vital component of issues of access and hindrance. So we know, the issues around the first 1,000 days of a child stimulation and education, both at home and at school, is significant. So once you've missed out that aspect in terms of, vital academic or cognitive development of a child, within the first 1,000 days, by the time a child gets to grade 12 and post-school education and so on, your interventions become so much more expensive, and I think there are many researchers who have done amazing work in this area. But for me, the very, very beginning is important. So those, the youngest of us are, and the most vulnerable of us, need to be targeted. Special schools are another area in terms of learners in a particular kind of category. The quality of education, again, itself, we know, and we are completely encouraged by the fact that access to schooling for South Africans is, learners, has increased, and we're sitting in a very good position in terms of access and availability of education. But now we need to target issues of quality of that education. And then again, the issue of textbooks. So there are many issues that speak to hindrance, but even when a learner is in the context of classroom. One of the reasons why we speak of the nutrition program is that a child can be sitting in a classroom with beautiful textbooks that have arrived on time, with a teacher who is committed and amazing and incredibly qualified, but if that learner is hungry, there isn't a lot that we're going to achieve. And so again, I think even though we focus specifically on infrastructure and nutrition and scholar transport, which hinder access to education, once you even have a learner in the classroom, they need to question what kind of education are they getting, and is the education actually reaching them at that level, cognitively. But again, it's this ECD, early child development, and the actual quality and nutrition aspects, developmental aspects. The transparency question, and what, whether this is reflected, this is a national problem for us. To some extent, we find that we do have access to provincial budget because we can visit the provincial office, we can, work at that level. But what is required is a comprehensive availability of budget information with, across various projects or programs on it. This isn't only the EIG, there are various others, and I'd be happy to elaborate outside of this context on where exactly the issues of transparency reflect themselves. ICD is perhaps the biggest area where transparency is a problem, and this is a national, in a national context. And then lastly, I think the issue of, what are the solutions? Some of them really do speak to, individuals taking an active stance in terms of education, individuals getting involved within the school community, parents being involved in SGDs. So there certainly is a question about what we as individuals can do, and also to just ask questions, even at the school level, of the principal. What is your budget? How is the budget being spent? What are you aware of? What does your school deserve? Some principals we've visited, for example, aren't even aware that their school should be upgraded, and so there also goes a question of our own proactive engagement in terms of the solution. So it's not just about the money. I agree with the chair and committee member. But just to close, I'd just like to say thank you for this opportunity. It's been fantastic for us, and we really are encouraged also by your supportive engagement. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. We will be in touch with you. Thank you very much. Honorable members, there is no lunch yet, so I guess we take the presentation from the two universities, and once they are done, we can break for lunch. I'm hoping by that time there will be lunch. To the presenters, I forgot to say to you that we have a budget office here in Parliament. Be in touch with them, because the lot of work that you are doing, we want them to look at it. Okay? Right. Let's take this and UNIPA presentation, and then we will then break for a short lunch. Is Kosatu here now? Okay, Kosatu has arrived. We will end with Kosatu. So if we don't have time, we're going to cut Kosatu. I will have to come back tomorrow. Okay, we'll try and hear you, Kosatu, before you leave. We might just reduce time for engagement and allow for written submissions and answers. Is that there ready? Yunisa, there? You are ready? Okay. You'll introduce yourself and your team and then take us through. I take it as a general presentation. Okay.
Honorable Chair, members, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for the opportunity and for us to present you with some of our research findings. This research was done by Prof. Stubb, who is the head of the School of Economics and Business Sciences at HITS, by Ms. Adele Breitenbach, and myself, who are both from UNISA, the Department of Economics. So just to confirm, this is very focused research. I'm not going to talk about tertiary education in general, so we are just here specifically to talk on what we have recently published, and that is on South Africa's fiscal cliff revisited. Okay, so just briefly, the presentation will focus on some aspects of social assistance payments, remuneration of civil service, and then, as I mentioned, the possible fiscal cliff facing South Africa and also tax revenue increases, so the various options we have there. And before I proceed, I would also like to make apology for Prof. Stowe and Ms. Breitenbach for not being here. Prof. Stowe has a very important meeting this afternoon, a tenant meeting at the varsity that he cannot miss. And also very important, I think we've heard a lot about the importance of especially social assistance and the various grants. So important before we start is that our comment is not on the effectiveness or the results of these payments. I think the previous speaker said or ended on the note that it is not about the money. Unfortunately, in our presentation, it is about the money. So that is where our focus is, on the statistical trends, especially given the fiscal restraint that by now we all know about. Okay, so I think important for us, we know the term fiscal cliff is, of course, borrowed from the U.S., where they use the fiscal cliff in terms of their debt ceiling, or where they can't borrow anymore. For us, we borrowed that term, and we said that's the point where civil service remuneration plus social grant expenditure equals government revenue. So there is no money left for any other expenditure item. Also important, this research is actually three research papers that were done. Firstly, on civil service remuneration and on actually living standards that we took over in terms of social assistance payments. And then we realized that we were comparing similar things to revenue, and we combined those research. So it's the culmination of various public research. Now, by 2012, it was clear that the South African government was heading for fiscal cliff, with total expenditure and the remuneration of civil servants exceeding all government revenue possibly by 2026. If the trends that were observed between 2008 and 2012 were allowed to increase as they were at that stage. Now, this is a summary of our findings at that stage. You will see the first 5 years there, the blue bar is government revenue. Sorry, that should be revenue, not expenditure. And the red bar is social expenditure and salary. So the combination of social expenditure and salaries is the red one. And as you can see, between 2008 and 2012 already, how quickly that red one is catching up with the blue one. So it was quite a straightforward calculation that we did. We simply extrapolated on that, and that's where we got that original figure of 2026. So very little
detailed econometrics or mathematics that went into that. That was a plain, straightforward fact that if the trend continues, that is not sustainable. Now, this, I just want to show the mention of the word fiscal cliff. So we were quite, I should say, pleased. But again, the only thing I want to say there is that the trade has taken notice also of this still that we have been using. Again, this is work in progress, and at this stage already I can say that we haven't published our latest research, and we are thinking of changing that to include, should it be a fiscal cliff, a fiscal slope, or a fiscal plateau. So that's very important for us. We are the first findings was based on very, you can say, not very detailed research. But so since then, what has been happening? We have been monitoring this very closely, especially given a lot of attention and research or questions that we have been receiving. We are finding some trend to be concerning and confusing, especially the decline in the child support grant post-2020. I know that has to do with some uptake rates, but again, from our point, we all don't always have all the information. A number of grant recipients increased from about 60 million currently to 17.3 billion in 2017-18, and that's a growth rate of about 2.5% per annum. Again, there's the graph that we are alluding to from the budget review, and there you can see the decline from 2020, for example, in the child support grant. So for us, for modeling purposes, it's very difficult to work with these variable trends in terms of forecasting, because you have to make some assumptions. Social assistance is, of course, part of social development expenditure. This is the cost and the number of recipients. The blue bar there is the cost, and you can see between 2008 and 2015, basically doubling from 60 billion to 120 billion. So again, doubling in the space of 7 years, so that's a growth rate of about 10.5% per annum. Yes, as I mentioned, that's just the figures. Recently, it has been at least the growth rate in the expenditure item has declined, but it still requires careful monitoring. Okay, so the other side of the analysis, the civil service servant remuneration, the number of employees in the public sector, central plus provincial, has increased at a steady rate of about 3.1% per annum since 2005. Although some deceleration in this growth rate was discernible in the 2012-13 fiscal year, civil service employment has again accelerated in 2013-14, and it is still too early to assess the growth rate for the 2014-15 fiscal year. Just to show you the figures of what I've just been talking about, there you can see the percentage change year on year, the last column there, come down from 4.4% the year on year growth to 1.3% in 2013, and then a slight acceleration that I spoke about of 2% again. So we will have to monitor that. On average, an increase of 3.1% in the number of civil servants. These figures we got from the South African Reserve Bank. So that was the number. Now, if we look at the actual compensation, again, quite a significant increase from 2007-8. There you can see the percentage changes. Obviously, growth rate of 19%, 17%, 13% is really, in our view, not sustainable. It's very, very high growth, especially given what the economy was doing around 2008-09 with the financial crisis. The red figures there is the most recent one that we could pick up from the medium-term budget presentation. And there you can see the expected rate going forward. So the budgeted expectations is much lower, about 6.8% to 6.6%, 6.4%. So, it is too early to predict an overall decline in the growth trend since 2005. I think that last point there, the budgeted increase is in the region of 6 to 7% per annum. For us, this seems a little bit low, especially given the recent historic trends. However, this is something that we will have to monitor. We want to really commend the minister on budgeting for these figures, and it will be great if we can manage to keep to these budgeted figures. But as we are just giving the warning that given the trend, it seems a little bit optimistic. Okay, so what is driving government compensation? Again, I don't want to go into too much detail on this. This was research done by Professor and Breitenbach, but amongst other things, inflation not increases, etc. Now, just to also prove our point or to have a little bit more analysis from our side on where we think the remuneration account is going to. If we take the average employment growth of 3.1% that have been observed and the general adjustment for inflation, let's say about 6 to 6.5% plus 1 percentage point, it gives us roughly 10% increase per annum in the cost of this item. So there we have got what we got from the budgeted one from 2014-15 to 2017-18. The figure on the right-hand side is from the medium-term budget presentation, starting at 440 billion in 2014-15 and going to 533 billion in 2017-18. And the ones on the left is if we use that roughly 10% per annum increase, as I explained just now, the difference between what it could be and what it actually budgeted for. And that is also a cumulative underestimation of up to 136 billion in just the next four fiscal years. So, again, this is a lot of assumptions that goes into this, but it's clear warning signs that we need to be able to keep, or it's very important that we stick to the minister's plan. Okay, so now just to some more recent analysis that we have done. So we a few assumptions that go to this is baseline analysis that we expect the assumption that the take-up rate in social grants will increase for the next decade and then level out. It is assumed that the economy will grow as announced by the minister, or roughly 3% per annum. It is also assumed that government remuneration will increase by roughly 10% per annum, as I've explained. And also what we included in the next slide, you will see an extra scenario where the recent talk of 15% or the demand of 15% increase in civil service remuneration for the period 2015-17 is also included as the analysis. So given these assumptions, this is what we find. Again, the blue bar there, that is government revenue, and our projections going forward, that's of course the limiting factor here. I haven't given all our background for how we get to government revenue. I can just say that at this stage we are using econometric models. We are no longer simply using averages to forecast it. So we've got an econometric model to forecast government revenue. And then the red body, that is the social assistance plus remuneration. Then the black line, that's the one, if we take the percentage of the red to the blue one, and that you read on the right-hand side of the graph. As you can see, increasing from about 42% in 2008 to almost 55-56% in 2012, and there you can see an increasing trend in that black line. So as percentage of remuneration, these two expenditure items continue to increase as a percent. Then, as I also said, the yellow or the extra scenario, what if we keep that 15% per annum increase for the period 2015 to 2017, and there you can see the jump, the yellow line, a significant difference that only that 3 years make in the forecast of it. Also very important here is you'll see the question is now, so has the fiscal cliff that we've spoken about previously been averted? And our analysis shows that the fiscal cliff is still approaching because that line is continuing to increase, but it's way further in future. So that's again, as I alluded to also at the beginning, we also started thinking, should we rather talk about something like a fiscal slope or a fiscal plateau that we have reached? And are we currently happy with the level that we are on? So some research questions that we are still facing. We haven't published the most recent research yet, so any input there will be very, very welcome. Important is therefore necessary to contain the growth in civil service employment, and ideally the size of cabins should be reduced to help in achieving this objective. There is no scope to increase civil service remuneration by more than the rate of inflation plus 1 percentage point. Now in the recent NDVPS, we got the figures that government requires spending cuts of about 25 billion and an additional revenue of 44 billion for the period to 2017-18. Just as a side note almost, this is not stated clearly if it is nominal or real amounts. Obviously, if it's real amounts, then it could be as much as 48 billion instead of 44 billion. So this implies that new and additional taxes to raise the revenue, but the problem is the opportunity to increase revenue is very limited. Maybe I can just say at this stage, we sort of moved away now from the
basic analysis that we were doing to more looking at revenue and where we can find additional revenue sources. So this is just some additional research that we are working on. I'm sure the members know these figures better than I do. They are the government revenue by source. So the three major items there, of course, your personal income tax, your value-added tax, and your corporate income tax. So three main sources, as I have mentioned them, and it's likely that if we want to source additional revenue, that it should come from those three heavyweight items. Now, we've done a few calculations on where we can get the additional 44 billion, and in that calculation, we just assumed an elasticity of 10%. Okay, what we mean by that is, for example, the reduction of people working less in response to higher income tax, or people driving less in response to increase of fuel prices. So it's sort of arbitrary assumption that we are making, but we have to assume some elasticity that people will react to higher taxes. Now, possibilities, what we've factored in is, for example, increase of two additional marginal tax brackets, 45% for taxable income above 1 million and 50% for taxable income above 2 million. Increase around 10% in other main revenue sources as highlighted below. I'll show you the figures just now. Okay, so this is what the new tax table will look like with the two additional tax marginal tax rates included, for the 45% and the 50%. More important for this research is how much income we can get from that. I haven't given all the figures here, but roughly 7.5 billion that we say we can get from personal income tax. So if I can maybe just take you through the first one, the first row there, the personal income tax. So originally budgeted for 335 billion. If we do the marginal rate adjustments as we show in that tax table, that's where we got the 7.5 billion. The reduction is due to the elasticity effect, as I explained. So that gives you a net increase of 6.7 billion, which amounts to 342 billion instead of 335. So again, we just really played around with some scenarios here, increasing the VAT rate by 1 percentage point to 15, or increase corporate tax rate to 30%, and there you can see the effects of these various increases. Important for us is the total revised income of about 44 billion. So again, this is a lot of assumptions, and it can change. It's just one scenario that we sketched here. Okay, so a few final remarks and conclusions. As we say, the fiscal cliff has not yet been averted, but it's further in the distance than we originally thought in 2012. It is necessary to contain growth in civil service employment, and ideally the size of cabinet should be reduced. Limiting government expenditure is preferable to raising of taxes in an effort to avert this cliff. There is no scope for increased civil service remuneration by more than inflation plus 1%. And the room for raising additional income is very limited. An additional tax burden, although we haven't done detailed research on that, but it is likely to have a negative impact on the economic growth performance, which of course is a determining factor behind all of this, as you heard in the first presentation also today. This is not directly part of our research, but some questions over custom duties that we inverted the amount paid over to the SACU members, and especially given South Africa's unfiscal needs at this stage. Then we would like to think that the 2014 NCVPS indicates that government has taken notice of our research. However, I think there are some other trends that were also very likely that they saw themselves. So, but we would like to see that we helped a little bit in showing this. And again, as we stated, the implication is clear. South Africa must limit the size and growth of its civil service and ideally reduce the size of its cabinet, if it wants to avert the fiscal cliff. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. That's the presentation from both members of the two universities. I suggest, members, that we don't deal with the issue of tax, because I think the Finance Committee will be doing public hearings on that. So you will probably have to come back to present to them, because they're also looking at the Davis Commission report. I don't know when they'll do those public meetings. I think we'd rather leave that part to them for now. Shall we have a short break? I think there is some food now in the room. If I can allow for short break, 30 minutes. We eat. And I would suggest to honorable members, in the course of the lunch, I want you to read something, the draft report. Just read it quietly as you eat. Because by the time we come back after the presentation, we'll then see whether there are any changes we want to make before it's prepared for tomorrow. Have lunch with us. We will ask questions after lunch. I'm sure you can stay another 30 minutes. And then we will take concert to, after concert will be the last. Hoping there will still be time. Okay, let's
Oh, yeah, before that. I was suggesting that we'll do the time for lunch so we can hear concert. I would like to hear.
15 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. Another 30 minutes we should be done, and then we'll take concert too, and then we'll do our report. I want to try and get everybody out of here by 2:30 so that we're able to go and prepare to. We don't have to go to the house running. So, are you ready for us? Who wants to take this? Honorable Chop?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Vets, for showing us the cliff. I just want to know if we seriously allocate resources for industrialization, and if we improve our manufacturing and beneficiation, is it not possible to deal with the challenges and move away from the cliff? Thank you.
Who wants to be honorable McLaughlin?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. If I just refer you to slide 10 of your presentation. That you said that the trend was that the employees in the public sector increased 3.1% per annum since 2005, and I see you've taken that through into your predictions into the future. Given the fact that current amendment, the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, puts a peg on that and says, like, we're going to not find any more unfilled vacancies and things like that, have you taken that into account that the intention now is that there will not be that 3.1% increase? I understand that because it happened, that's why you included it, because that's been the trend. But if we were successful in bringing that out of zero shutter, what real event or what real effect would that have? Can you manage to give us an indication of what your feeling would be? And then the last bullet point on the same page, you have 2 editors, road track. It's predicted at the moment that 1.4% was revised down to that. What is your indication at this stage? Would you agree that 1.4% growth in this year is a realistic forecast, or would you think that that's maybe too high, or are we being too optimistic or too pessimistic? Thank you.
Anybody else want to come? Okay, you may respond.
Thank you for the question. I think on the first question about the effect of industrialization and manufacturing, that is really area that we did not research in this case. So
If I may take the opportunity again to say that we will possibly provide a written response to this one, but I do not wish to elude on that because that is outside the scope of what we did in this specific week. We only look at those two expenditure items. So I can discuss this with the prof. Maybe he has a better answer. So,
And beneficiation.
Beneficiation, yes, I've got it like that. So I will look at it. Thank you. Okay, in terms of the trends since 2004, I think very important that I think I also made the point where was that when you looked at this slide, you said from where we are sitting and you must appreciate that we are in an academic environment and we get this information secondhand, and we can only, I think, for us the safest is to work with actual figures. So again, as I also said, it would really be, or we hope that will in fact be the real, or will be the outcome, that there will be no new increases in terms of, you know, new persons being employed, but it's unlikely. That's just my one viewpoint from that side. The effect will be dramatic, that I can tell you, because it will bring our expected growth rate in civil service remuneration down from what we modeled in as 10% to about 7% or even 6.5%. So it will definitely have a significant effect on the I can't give you exact figures of where this graph, but it's likely even that line will start to decline. So that will be great, because as you are standing, and that's also one of our suggestions, that